It's time for Twink This Week in Google. Stacey Higginbotham is here, so is Jeff Jarvis, and all the way from France, Mike Elgin. We have suggestions for what to do to fix Twitter. We're going to talk about changes with Hangouts and why Google Fi may be the best cell carrier ever. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twig.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 362, recorded Wednesday, July 20th, 2016. This Week in Google is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/twig and enter the promo code TWIG. And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/twig and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/twig. And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you could post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/twig. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we cover the latest news, not just from Google, but from the cloud, from the Googleverse, from anywhere in the world, including Aix-en-Provence. That's where Mike Elgin joins us from.
Yes, and it is lovely here. The weather is wonderful, and the wine and the cheese is fantastic. And not only that, the other fantastic thing is nougat.
Oh, look at that!
I've been testing nougat, and I tell you, it's a very rich and full-bodied operating system.
That's a hefty chunk of nougat you got there, Mr. Elkin.
We discovered that this piece of, you know, the woman who sold this to us hacked off this piece, and we found out how much it cost. This is more than $50 right now.
What?
Yeah. Why did you not ask for a smaller chunk?
Because I didn't know it would cost this much. You know, we figure how much could it possibly cost?
Right? Oh, but it is delicious, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. But this is made with honey, and this is the really hardcore kind of caramel stuff. Flavor. But it's so delicious. It is so good.
I remember when I was a little kid, like 11 years old, going to the south of France, and there's some town that's like Nougat Town.
Yeah.
And I've told this story before. There was like nougat everywhere. Even the gas station sold nougat. And I love nougat. Oh.
Yeah. I had never tried it other than, you know,
Americans
you find
don't
the
eat
bottom
it.
Of whatever candy bars.
It's good. And by the way, it looks like you've got great internet. Are you at an Airbnb?
I'm at an Airbnb, and it really is great. But, you know, we're in the old part of the city, so this is a very old building. You can tell because all the plumbing and electricity is external. Nothing goes through the walls. And so I was around the corner, and the internet connectivity was a fraction of what it is right here within sort of line of sight with the Wi-Fi. The signal doesn't really go through the walls here, which I discovered right before the show. It was not good enough until I actually came into this room.
Sit in the window. Well, good. We're thrilled to have you.
I'm glad to be here.
Our digital nomad, Mike Elgin. Also with us, Jeff Jarvis, back from his digital jaunts. Actually, you've been back for a while, which is nice. We're glad to have you.
Yeah, once.
BuzzMachine.com, the author of What Would Google Do? And Geeks Bearing Gifts, and professor of journalism at CUNY. And from Austin, Texas, where it must be 150 degrees right now, Stacey Higginbotham. Is it hot?
It's 101.
Oh, man. And humid.
So, yes.
Oh. Do you have to have AC if you live there?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Because you're not even glowing. You just look calm, cool, collected.
Yes, it is a cool 77 in here.
Nice. Actually, that would be hot for me.
Okay, well, I'm a lady, and I guess we're
men's sweat. What is it? Horses sweat, men perspire, women simply glow.
Oh, I thought we glistened. No, glow? I don't know.
I believe it's a pretty antiquated statement. I think it would be considered politically incorrect these days to repeat that.
Women can sweat too.
Women's, and as a matter of fact, I've learned since I learned that as a child, women sweat. And it's a good thing. Sweating's good. Sweating's great. It feels great to sweat. And if you don't sweat in the summer, you're sitting on the couch. You're not playing Pokemon Go. Have you caught the infection, Stacey, and your child?
I have not. My child doesn't have a smartphone, so we haven't been playing it. I was going to load it. She's only 9. We could talk about when to get her a smartphone, actually. That's a
that's an interesting question, isn't it? Yeah.
And I went to download it. The servers were not working, so that was at that point in time, and then I just kind of gave up. I'm lame. I'm sorry. I could have, cleaned up in Maine, too.
Oh, it's so funny. It's the greatest game, but the servers are incessantly down. Today was the day it was supposed to launch in Japan, of course, the country from which Pokemon emerged and the most Pokemon crazy country in the world. And we knew the servers would be devastated. They delayed it, saying partly because of the leak. I guess this was going to be the first test of sponsored Pokestop locations. McDonald's was going to have Pokestops at all the McDonald's. The email about that leaked to TechCrunch, and Niantic, the company that makes Pokemon Go, said they are not going to put it out today. To everybody's great relief, although I'm wondering if they end up doing it because it is down, down, down. John Hankey, who's the CEO of Niantic, said, "We are not going to put it in Japan until we believe the servers can handle the traffic."
It's a bad thing for Google Cloud, man. It's looking...
Yeah, because it's all cloud. It's all Google Cloud.
So, I have no idea how it's architected or anything, but I'm very curious to see what the cause is.
We've been trying to find out. I've read articles. One article said that they are working on Google... What is it? Code Engine? Cloud Engine?
Cloud Engine.
But then it pulls from Google Maps... But on Saturday on the new Screensavers, we've got a network engineer who doesn't have direct knowledge of it, but who can speculate a little bit about what the issues are and why it's so hard to scale.
Well, there's a lot of, you've got the real time back and forth on what can be kind of shoddy connections, depending on where you are. And then you've also got pulling from different aspects of Google services.
Right.
So there's a lot of back and forth there.
I know, and it's very frustrating because I see a Jigglypuff, but I can't get it. You know how that is?
I don't want to hear those words coming out of your mouth.
Are they playing Pokemon Go in France, Mike Elgin?
They are. Well, it's funny because here in the part of the city where we are, it's the old part, so you can tell that the streets are all sort of carved out in the Middle Ages. They're all curvy and narrow.
That's so cool.
So... when you see on the map where there are Pokemon, you know exactly where they are because the streets are like 12 feet wide or something. There's not big open spaces around here where they could be anywhere in the vicinity. So it's kind of funny. I just looked at the screen. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right in front of the burger place. And I know exactly where they would put it, that one. But, Leo, I'm curious about what you think.
Well, you wrote the most vicious article about it.
Well, it was taken as an anti-Pokemon article. I basically said that it's a public menace.
Well, and that sounds anti-Pokemon to me.
Well, but the reason it's a public menace is simply because it's, number one, super popular, and number two, I think we're at a really interesting point right now where we culturally haven't adapted to mixed reality and augmented reality applications. We haven't learned how to function in society with virtual objects all around us, and I think you've mentioned on previous shows, I believe it was Twit, that, how great would Google Glass be with this thing? I mean, it would be really great. You'd keep heads up and you'd be more aware of your surroundings. I really do think that Google Glass-like glasses will come out that are not bulky and ugly, that are socially acceptable. And I think augmented and mixed reality applications like Pokemon Go and other things are going to kind of mainstream that piece of hardware. And I think that's going to be great. But right now, I think, we've sort of adapted to, for example, texting. People, jackasses, still drive and text and stuff like that. But for the most part, etiquette and social norms are arriving around texting. I think eventually that will happen with mixed reality. I think that 3 years from now, there will be, 50 or 100 augmented or mixed reality applications that lots and lots of people are using. So it won't be like everybody using the same one.
Jeff, you disagree?
Well, I think you found the thing I put in the rundown. Your cursor is on it.
guy playing Pokemon while driving?
Oh, the Baltimore guy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll get Karsten to play it for us. So apparently, this is police video, dash cam video from a police car. Guy playing Pokemon Go runs into about the worst thing you could run into, a Baltimore police cruiser. Let's see if we could see the video here. I think you can go full screen on it, Karsten. Yeah. And this is for people listening. Same thing happened to me, so it wasn't just me. For some reason, that page
from our Southeast District
does not allow us to scroll up and see it. Oh, yeah. It's off screen. Same thing happened to me. I thought maybe it was...
Click off to that tweet, then you can do it.
That's all right. I get the idea.
Yeah.
To me, the phenomenon, the danger around Pokemon is there's nothing about Pokemon that's bad. It's a cool, fun game, but it's kind of like Black Friday, right? I mean, people are focused on something other than paying attention to where they're going and what they're doing. And they're in a competitive kind of situation, so there's a bit of a frenzy sometimes with these large mobs. And I think that's really the thing. It's not Pokemon itself. It's just large numbers of people, dozens of millions of people out there wandering around and not really paying full attention to where they're going and what poles they're walking into and what cliffs they're falling off and so on. So
I don't think a heads-up display is going to help that too much.
No,
because
it's going to be worse.
You're still going to be focused on the virtual, right, and not the actual reality.
I think given how insane this craze has become, and I don't know what it's like in France, but everybody's playing it everywhere I go, there are surprisingly few problems. You've got probably 100 million players and a handful of incidents. Most people are all right, although one of the issues, and I didn't really understand why people were walking off cliffs and climbing fences, because I didn't fully understand the game. There's a tracker in the game that you can use to try to, you could see what's nearby and try to track them down. And I think that's what's happening is people who are using the tracker were like looking at the tracker, seeing, am I close? Am I close? And then walking off of a cliff. Interestingly, Niantic claims it's a bug. I think it was intentional. The tracker hasn't worked in a couple of days. So yeah. I have a feeling that was in response to that.
But what I'm really excited about, what I think is fascinating from a culture point of view, is the fact that now a new generation of kids are going to grow up where it's normal to have virtual objects floating in space all over the place. And, you know, you think about kids who, you know, you see, we've all seen the videos of babies who pick up a magazine and try to swipe right and, you know, use it like an iPad. They, from the very beginning, are programmed to understand multi-touch interfaces, and that's that kind of thing. It's going to get to the point where it'll just be normal for these phantoms to be all around us. It's kind of like in the old days when people used to think that everything was haunted and there were ghosts and, you know, stuff like that all over the place. They'll be, in fact, be able to see these things. And again, it'll be lots and lots of things. It won't be just games. It'll be augmented reality and other stuff. But we're now entering in a whole new cultural world where there's a parallel universe or many parallel universes existing simultaneously in the same space. And I think culturally, that's really a weird and wonderful thing.
Yeah, that was my exact reaction.
Do any of you see any application for news?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I guess, well, maybe not news, but history. So, you know, news is the first draft of history, but you'll be able to sit, you know, walk around and say, well, this is the place where this took place. And it could be a historic event or...
Well, in fact, Niantic's first program was Field Trip, which did exactly that, right?
Yeah.
Right. But without augmented reality. But that, as you were walking by a point of interest, it would narrate it to you with your smartphone. The problem with news is news is not near you in general, right? So most of the time, the news we... most of the time the news we see is, like even here, okay, so there's a big fire at a dairy farm, lots of smoke in the air. This morning we're smelling it, it's smoky. Lisa said, I'm on the internet, there's a fire in the next county over, I can't find it. I said, no, it's not, it's nearby. It took us a while, we finally tracked it down to a farm, dairy farm not so far from us. But that's as local as you can get, and it's still that... I don't think there's any application for that. You certainly don't want people going, oh, let me go find the fire.
You could look at the smoke, and if there's a database, you could actually put your news stories that would say, hey, this is such and such dairy fire.
That's interesting.
Or, you know, traffic or
That's
like
true. Traffic.
Road work might be really interesting to pull up your phone and just.
Isn't that what Waze is already? Really?
Well, no. But like planned things, like we're right now, our major freeways under construction. I would love to be able to like pull up information about when this is now planned to be done. Cause it happens, you know, it gets updated every few months that, oh, this is going to be 2 months later. This is going to be 3 years later. So that's news ish.
You know, I wrote an article recently about the attack in Nice. And about the failure of the French government's, they commissioned an emergency app that is supposed to tell you what's going on and where to go and that sort of thing. And of course, people went to Twitter and Facebook to find out what's going on with their loved ones. So there's a real-time news is breaking right now kind of thing that has a practical dimension, which is like, what should you do? Is it happening near you? Is it happening relative?
That's good. Yeah.
But you can imagine a future where people do have smart glasses or are looking at their phones. And an augmented reality app pops up and says, there's an incident happening that way, and you need to go this way, and we'll guide you to a shelter, so or something like that. Or, you know, you can imagine the future of emergency services that use augmented reality to save lives and to give people immediate direction and attention. And again, one of the benefits of having smart glasses is that you don't happen to have to be looking at your phone at that exact moment. You can set it, say, okay, whenever there's an emergency, I want it in my glasses right away. And you can imagine that could be something really, really useful during breaking news events.
And I can also guarantee that the most interesting use is something we aren't even imagining, because that's how it often is with this kind of stuff.
No, it's porn. It's always porn.
First it's porn, then it's
Stacey is already imagining it.
Interesting. What if you really could get X-ray glasses, right?
Oh, dear.
Every boy's fantasy.
Yeah. Cabo Zone in our chat room said, I like this. What if you go to a historic place, you know, go to ruins? What if you went to the ruins at Palmyra and you saw the original buildings? You could put on your glasses and see the original buildings as they might have been. Wouldn't that be cool?
Or you could create like, not theater, but stories where people came in, you know, dressed up, actors played a role. I mean, just to make history kind of come alive.
Go to Pompeii, see the lava rolling in.
That would be
freaky. I'm wandering around France, and there are a surprising number of French people in this city who don't speak English at all. And I don't speak French. I speak a little French, but not enough. And so I've been using Google Translate. So the other day we were in a shop and we were just looking. And the person there asked us in French, I assume, can I help you? Would you like something? And so I just pulled out Google Translate and said, oh, we're just looking right now. Thank you. And I played it and it was instantaneous, worked great. She got a kick out of it. It was awesome. But if you could put that as augmented reality, that whole, you know, I could be shown what to say, here are three, you're in this type of shop. Here are some things you could say. This means... You know, and so it would be invisible to the other person. And so in my case, it would feel like knowledge. It would be a surrogate for actual skill and knowledge in speaking French. And I would love that. And of course, that's not exactly news, but that's a way that we could interact with the world that would be super practical and, you know, have a uniting effect, because in fact you could interact with people who speak other languages.
So do you think we'll look back at Pokemon Go in years to come and say this was when the virtual world started to become the real world? Or
look at how we look at Pokemon.
I don't know how we look at
it. We look back and it was
what was that all about? there's one kid here, Kevin's great, who was clearly obsessed with Pokemon, and he was at lunch today showing us all. He says, well, these are the legendary characters. They have not yet appeared in the Pokemon Go game. However, we have some theories that this character is going to really become Mutator. He's like, he knows every detail. And everybody's gathered around going, okay, suddenly there's this interest, like the knowledge that he has been maintaining for years with absolutely no value at all. And everybody's going, oh, yeah, tell us more, Kevin. Tell us more.
It's like the village shaman.
It's so great. It's so funny.
Good for him.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, on this idea of virtual reality, there is like there's a slight downside, which is it could create a potentially huge digital divide. One, if you don't embrace this, imagine how cut off you would be if everyone takes it for granted that you have these instant translation skills or you have the ability to see emergency breaking news on your phone. And then the other is, what was the other?
Well, we're already there, aren't we, in many ways, if you don't have the internet, don't you think? You feel pretty left out.
But there are people who don't have the internet, and it's a huge problem for them. And it's just
that gulf is only widening. You know, it's we talk about income inequality, but there's all kinds of related inequalities.
It's actually narrowing. I think more people are getting on the internet through more means.
I think both things are happening. There's a huge number of people who don't have the internet and therefore are completely locked out. On the other hand, there are people all over the world who can get lectures and coursework from MIT and Stanford. And they don't have to, you know, they're not among the elite who actually attend those schools. And all the information and knowledge of mankind that exists on the internet, which is available in little villages, if they have the internet. So it's simultaneously, as Jeff said, bringing people, erasing a digital divide. And at the same time, as more and more people get it and more people are not on it yet, it sort of creates a digital divide because, again, you have to have these tools. Otherwise, you just are just locked out of what's happening.
Well, to Stacey's point, as it becomes ubiquitous, then those who don't are really disadvantaged.
We're not having conversations about like privacy and, well, we're having them. We're just not changing anything. So you have to think about when you start giving like your actual location data up to everyone and their dog and, you know, governments start to rely on this, are we going to start having those conversations about what information people have and how they can use it? Because I do think we're moving down this path without really thinking about where it's going to lead us.
Well, I agree, although it's almost inevitable, right? I mean, what are you going to do? It's not, you can't say, well, let's stop. Wait a minute. Let's think about this.
No, but we could.
There's many, 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 many naysaying caution monsters out there. You know, as somebody who plays the optimist role most of the time, boy, do I get bombarded with people who say, but this could happen, but that could happen. And my response is always, well, if something could happen, do you then cut off all the possibilities by cutting off what it could be? That bad thing could happen. You cut off the good that could come too. We're smart, we people. We built civilization. We built buildings. We built Pokemon Go. We can do a lot of things.
We have Donald Trump running for president.
Well, I know. I almost completed. You know, Mike Elgin started this sentence. There are some people who don't have the internet, and I almost completed it, and they're voting for Trump. It does seem
I think Trump himself has the internet.
Apparently doesn't have the software that allows him to check.
He has Twitter.
Yeah, he has Twitter, which is the best part of the internet, right? Or the worst. It's simultaneously the best and the worst.
You know, there's a really interesting company that I don't think gets enough attention. I talked to the CEO, Julian Ranger, of Digimi. I don't know if you're familiar with Digimi, but essentially they're working on right now what you can do is download all of your social networking stuff, everything you've ever posted, every picture, other people's comments on your pictures.
Nice.
From the beginning of time on all social networks into a single place where you can slice and dice and search and do all this stuff. Very cool. Free app. It's a freemium model, so there's a paid version. But what he's working on is a system where you physically download all your stuff and control it and your information. And then he believes that he can get the companies like Google and Facebook and others to come to you and essentially make a deal with you about your data. Here's what we're going to do with it. Okay, I approve that. Here's what else we're going to do with it. No, I don't approve that. You can't do that. And sort of give you control of your data. It's a really fascinating and breathtakingly large vision. And the most fascinating part is they have this sense of responsibility about it where they don't want to actually control it too much. So I told them, why don't you just do a social network? It could be like a super friend feed where all my social networks would be in one place, just give me the opportunity to see other people's posts and post from that to everything else. And he's like, no, we're not going to do that because that's the mistake Twitter made. What Twitter did was they originally opened up the third parties. They let all these different companies do all these different things. And when anything started to succeed, they said, okay, well, now we're going to do that. And they locked those people out of it. And they were greedy about controlling the stuff that everybody was doing. And he said, that's the downfall. He said, we will never do that. We will let third parties do all that kind of stuff. Because no one company should have that much control and power. And by the way, even though they let you download all your data, they themselves have no access to it at all. And they encrypt it and all that kind of stuff as well. So Digimi is really an interesting company.
Let me show you.
Go ahead. My data is worthless on its own. It's only an aggregate that someone's data is useful to these companies. They don't care about me personally.
No, Stacey, I'll disagree there. What I've been arguing about the news business, for example, is we have to stop treating people as a mass. We have to start treating people as individuals. Now, we don't have the capability. You're quite right. But if we did have the capability where I can target you individually, I know you're a mother and your kid's this old and the kid likes this and things that you allow me to know to give you greater relevance, then I'm going to increase the value of our relationship hugely. But we're not good at that in media business because we used to treat everybody as a mass. Amazon does know you as an individual, and your data is valuable at an individual level. No, I don't think it's just an aggregate that the data is valuable. I think that if the company is set up well to give you personal service and relevance and value, then in turn your data is valuable to them because they've made it valuable to you.
Let me show you something a friend of mine, David Glickman, has just released. It's an iOS app. I'm curious what you think of this. It's called Our Data. It's an ad blocker. But it's a weird ad blocker because essentially you can agree to not be blocked, and the company that you're seeing their ads will share some of its revenue with you, which you can then give to charity. Right now it's Susan B. Komen, but they're going to add other charities to it. So the idea is, yes, your data has value, and in particular your attention to ads has value. Here's how you can kind of recover some of that money and make everybody happy, by the way, because the media companies are still getting the lion's share of it because you're seeing their ads instead of not with an ad blocker. And
do I have to give it to charity, Leo? Can I?
It would be nice if you could keep it. I don't know if you can keep it. I think it's a really interesting take on this. And it's the similar idea, which is it's your data. You should have control of it. But maybe this is a more practical approach to it, acknowledging that you're going to be giving out data and so kind of making a transaction around it. What do you think?
I could go for that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think the problem is the public doesn't care. I think
they're not going to care.
It would, if they could get a 50-cent discount on something, they'd give away all their data for life. I think the public has demonstrated, and we in the media have failed to... You know, we're either alarmists and the sky is falling, or we're, you know, it doesn't matter, don't worry about it, or we have these complicated stories about why it's a big deal. I think the public really doesn't understand it. It's a headache to think about, and they just would rather just get the benefits of using Facebook and all these other services without thinking about the data. And again, part of the problem is that it's really counterintuitive what's possible, what sort of story is possible to construct out of even just metadata for the communication.
Yeah, I guess the best we can hope to do is just let them know so that they at least kind of at least it's not completely in the dark about it. To your point, though, Mike, I'm thinking of the Google Surveys app I use.
Yeah.
Because I get like 30 cents and I give them whatever they want.
So I just got another one of those, Leo, where I got a United Airlines, and you know I'm a happy prisoner of United Airlines' global services. And I just got offered to, if I take a survey, and if I started this, I got 600 miles. Oh, okay, I'll do that. Right? And I'm thinking, oh, I'll make that every time. The next one is a 20-minute survey that gives me 60 miles. Not so much. But I did a long
JD Power. But at least now you've put a value on your data.
Yeah, so I know it's not 600.
Yeah.
And it asked me all kinds of demographic things because the advantage is I'll get a better survey. More valuable survey by them knowing that I'm this age and this education. And so
this is a sign that we're figuring it out.
Yeah, I think so too. There's a marketplace. I mean, that's the bottom line here. And Stacey's quite right that there needs to be the data on its own alone doesn't have value unless there's a context, unless I have a relationship with you that means that, oh, I can sell you something or I can show you something or I can give you greater value in something. And then that's the reason for you to reveal yourself to me is either because I'm paying you straight out or I'm paying you with better service or whatever it is.
So there's also this idea, and this kind of came to me while we were talking, in these virtual reality things, it adds another layer of not being able to control. So here's the scenario I would ask you guys to envision. If I'm walking down the street and someone holds up their phone, what's to stop them from seeing like virtual reality revenge porn affixed to me as a person?
Oh my God, yeah.
Or something. So that's another thing that I'm like, oh wait, that would be terrible. Think about the lack of power you have over Google searches. Imagine it actually applied to your face.
Maybe it just is a Google search. But remember, Google has that capability and turned it off. You know, they said, oh, one thing we won't do is face recognition.
Well, they never turned it on, yeah.
Yeah, or they didn't turn it on. But But it doesn't have to be revenge porn. What if I could just, I would personally love this, but you may not, hold up a phone and take a picture or see somebody and get the information about them.
Yeah. Do you remember, I think it was Highlight. Was that the app that showed you when people were around?
Nearby.
So
yeah.
That app creeped me out to no end. It's South by, you know, people would, you'd be looking around and you'd be like, oh my, I turned it off after.
It's
a
different experience. And I really have to acknowledge this for men and women.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
That's why I'm bringing it up. I'm
As the token woman on this panel. But I really have to acknowledge that we as guys, we don't have any idea how bad it can get.
So I think it also raises
the question of you know, that you suggested a disgusting application for the technology we know is coming, and you know, people can be awful, but it raises a kind of philosophical question about what's the difference between a computer augmented fantasy and one that's purely mental. Is there a difference? It's an interesting question.
If I undress you in my head, is that...
I do not like the creeps who, when you walk down the street, undress you with their eyes.
And you can tell they're doing it, can't you?
Yeah, it's not subtle.
Nice. Yeah.
But this isn't just that. This is personal information you could affix to a person or a place. And think about swatting. There could be virtual, not swatting, actually, just virtual harassment.
Yes, stalking.
Associated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and of course, inevitably, as we've seen again and again with all these technologies, all of this will happen.
Yeah.
So, yes. And we still suck at deal. I mean, look at Twitter and how poorly
I want to talk about Milo Yiannopoulos in just a second.
Yes. I was just about to bring up Milo.
Okay, don't. Stand by for Milo in a moment. First, I love doing this show. When we get these great people, Mike Elgin is here. He's from Aix-en-Provence, en France. He is becoming a digital nomad. Is it becomingnomad.com?
Becomingnomad.com, yeah. Yes.
And he's drinking red wine, which makes me so jealous.
French wine, yes, yes. Oh. Yeah, and I advocate the nomadic lifestyle. Everybody should try it at least once.
It sounds like you're saying I advocate the nude lifestyle, and everybody should try it just once. It's funny. It's
similar to nudism. Nomadic nudism is my new.
You don't have any clothes.
You're out there, man. You're out there.
Aren't nudists? Don't they call themselves naturalists?
Naturists, not naturalists. Naturists.
Naturalists know leaves and birds. Naturists.
That's right.
I have been to naturist places in my life. When I was in high school, we used to go to the nude beach all the time, and it was innocent. Well, and you immediately get over it, right? That's the thing I should point out is...
Yeah, because the people who frequent such beaches are not...
Well, even then, it's just, even if they were all gorgeous, it doesn't matter. They're just, it takes you literally 1 minute to go, okay, I get it, and just be normal again. There's a hot springs up here, same thing, or Tassajara. And you just get used to it. It's just like...
Saunas in Germany, as we discussed.
Saunas in Germany, right. In some ways, I think that's the better way to do this is just to say, you know, we all have bodies and not make it a taboo, because that's where it becomes creepy, when it becomes a taboo. But at the same time, I respect your right not to walk around naked.
I think that when you the biggest thing you learn when you go to a nude beach is you gain an appreciation for clothing. It's awesome.
Also with us, it's always wonderful, Stacey Higginbotham. We missed you terribly last week. I'm so glad you're back.
You know, I want to say something here. I see this on Twitter all the time. No one. Gina Trapani, her number is retired. No one replaces Gina. But Stacey, I'm so grateful you're on the show. You get tremendous reviews. All the fans of the show are so happy you're here. I'm happy you're here. I know Leo's happy you're here. I just wanted to say, you are a joy and a brilliant addition, and I'm so glad you're here.
Yeah. Yep. I second that. IoT Podcast. If you can't get enough, go to IoTpodcast.com for her Internet of Things podcast with our other great friend, Kevin Toefel, who will be on your show but refuses to be on our show.
No, he's asking.
Oh, good.
He'd love to come on the show.
Yeah, he's been asking for about a month now.
I learned something about Kevin when I was trying to book him for
TNT, which is that he's very schedule oriented. So if you catch him on short notice, he's never available.
Right.
But if you say, okay, in September, can you do this date? He'll say yes, and he'll be there.
Well, in this case, it's because he's now working as a consultant to Google.
Right. Right.
So he has to get permission, as I think everybody does. You know, we got so spoiled by Matt Cutts because he was employee number 11. He can just do whatever.
And trusted.
Yeah. But now he can't, by the way. He's now working for the government.
Oh, so is that the case?
Well, it's just like Kevin. He says, well, I have to get permission. I don't want to do it without permission.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah. We've mentioned this before, but just in case you don't know, Matt has gone to work for a group that's, I think, a great... It's kind of like Code for America, the idea of these really smart coders and technologists helping make government work better, more transparent. And I think it's...
He's at the Pentagon.
He's at the Pentagon, yeah.
Yeah, Colonel
the Pentagon
Colonel Cutts
has weaponized Matt Cutts.
Well, somebody had to. I'm just glad it was our side. Also here, Jeff Jarvis, who we love dearly, too, professor of journalism at CUNY.
No, you don't. No one does. But that's
I love you. Time. You're my brother from another mother.
And just look at that beard.
I know. He's gorgeous. He's gorgeous.
I think that's part of the problem today is that I'm hitting the white balance.
Oh,
on
your
the
beard is. Yeah, that's what it is. You have a little Gandalf thing going there.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, you're blinding the camera. Our show today brought to you by the great Casper mattress. You wouldn't think a mattress would be part of the revolution, but it is. It is. It's part of the internet revolution, changing the way we do business in this country. Casper mattresses are made in the U.S. They're made by engineers obsessing to make the best premium mattress possible using the latest materials. They combine springy latex foam with supported memory foam to give you just like a Goldilocks sleep, just the right amount of sink and bounce so you get the perfect night's sleep. And by the way, on these hot summer nights where it's 102 degrees in Austin, you're going to love this because Casper mattresses sleep cool. They breathe, and that really helps you sleep better. 2016 Business Intelligence Group Innovation Award winner, the Casper mattress, and all of that for less because there's no middle person. You don't have to go to a mattress store. Now, you may say, but Leo, I hear you now saying, but Leo, I like to go to the mattress store. I want to try before I buy. Yeah, but let me point out that 5 minutes on a mattress in broad daylight with a salesperson kind of giving you the stink eye is not the best way to see what it's going to be like to sleep on that mattress. So Casper's got a better way, 100 nights to try, 100 nights. And if at any time in that first 100-day period you don't like it for any reason, you call Casper, they send a courier, they take it away, they refund every penny. So it's really risk-free. Free shipping and returns in the U.S. and Canada. They uphold the highest environmental production standards. So they don't smell rubbery or anything. They're just fresh and clean and beautiful. You spend a third of your life on your mattress. Make it a good one. Make it a Casper. $500 for a twin, $950 for a king size, but we're going to give you an additional $50 off when you go to Casper, C-A-S-P-E-R, Casper.com/twig, and use our promo code T-W-I-G. That's Casper.com/twig, promo code twig, for $50 off. Some terms and conditions apply. Live the dream with your beautiful Casper mattress. I haven't seen Ghostbusters, the new Ghostbusters, yet. I'm dying.
No spoilers.
Nope.
It's impossible to have a spoiler.
Have you seen it?
No, I'm going Friday.
I'm dying to see it.
Me too.
It really shocked me that there was this kind of undercurrent after the first trailer of people saying, "Oh, women shouldn't be Ghostbusters."
I
was like, "What
disgusting.
Do you mean?" Well, and then I found out that there's this kind of general consensus among some that women aren't funny, which is funny because maybe because I just know a lot of funny women, but I think some of the best comics working today are women.
Absolutely,
including Melissa McCarthy, who's in the new Ghostbusters, and I never remember her name. The smart Ghostbuster. And
then Leslie Jones?
No, well, Leslie Jones is the black Ghostbuster. Oh. If we're going to...
Kristen you know Wiig and...
Kristen Wiig's in it, who's hysterical.
Kristen Wiig.
And who is... And
she's new and she's great.
She is.
Yeah. I love her. Anyway, Leslie Jones was getting a lot of nasty, not only misogynistic, but racist.
Horribly racist.
Tweeting, and did, I thought, a brave, courageous thing. She retweeted them.
Yep.
Oh, which, you know, that's got to be hard to do.
Let's stop there for 1 second. I agree it's brave. Was it the best tactic?
Wow. Well, there's a lot. We debate about this all the time. All of us have been harassed on Twitter, and I think all...
Was it feeding the troll, or was it exposing the troll? Does the troll care?
I think it's exposing... So people either think it's not their problem, or they're willfully blind to some of the misogynistic and racist things that happen. And I think it's important for people to see it. And I say that as someone who... I actually don't get a lot of harassment on Twitter. Please don't start.
Don't say anything. You know, that's another thing, by the way. What a chilling effect this has, doesn't it?
Yes.
I almost don't even want to talk about it because I don't want to encourage them.
No, you should talk about it. You should tell people that it's unacceptable. Because the problem is people who are in the majority and people, they don't see it or they don't understand it and they don't speak up about it.
I had Virginia Heffernan on Triangulation on Monday. She's got a new book on the internet, Magic.
That was great. That was great, Leo, yeah.
And we had this conversation and she said, I was kind of shocked because she has been harassed on Twitter. Somebody said she's worse than ISIS. Which is such a ridiculous insult. She said, well, but it's not physically damaging to you, so it's harmless. She kind of stuck up for the free speech aspect of it. And I said, well, I don't think it is harmless. It's psychologically damaging, there's bullying. There are people who have killed themselves because they've been bullied on Facebook and Twitter. It could be damaging to your career. It could be damaging to your relationships.
Think about if someone tweets a picture of your kid's school at you.
There you go.
I mean, that's scary as all hell.
Doxing, that is highly damaging. So we had that argument. She's not here, so I'm not, I don't want to, attack her in absentia. But some people do say, I think I shouldn't put words in her mouth, read her book, Magic and Loss. And we're trying to get her on the show. But I think what she was saying is, I've said this myself, sunshine is the best disinfectant. That putting this out in the public eye, she said, "Hey, you're going to learn a lesson. You learn a lesson about yourself and have to look at yourself." And I said, "Well, I don't think most of the time there's much of a lesson."
That's being very generous.
Generous. And then she also pointed out that she was talking about Gawker revealing the affairs of some gentleman and to his wife. And that was good because the woman was being gaslighted and she needed to hear the truth. And I said, yeah, but maybe from relatives or friends, but not from.
Well, not in full public
from
view.
Gawker.
You know, if a friend tells you, a friend will take you out for a drink and say, I got to tell you something. It's not very
pleasant.
And
do it gently. Yeah.
Yeah. Versus in the public. You know, the difference is I think that in the broad public square and in the public square that it is internet. Yes. Unbridled free speech, nothing you can do about it. ISIS is there. Good guys are there. Bad guys are there. But in a privately owned entity, institution, whether that institution is a platform, Twitter, or a publication, a magazine or a newspaper, or a book publisher, I think that those institutions, those entities have every right and sometimes a responsibility to set a standard and live by that standard. Now, okay, Twitter, because Twitter is open.
Let me continue with the saga here. And by the way, Kate McKinnon, awesome. That was the fourth Ghostbuster whose name I couldn't remember. So Leslie Jones she retweeted this stuff and then said, and I'm leaving, bye. Apparently, now I'm not sure what the connection is, Breitbart editor Milo Yiannopoulos, who's been suspended on Twitter before, was banned by Twitter. I guess he had some
terrible racist
things. And he more importantly encouraged others to do the same.
Which I've long said is actually the greater issue. You're going to find trolls out there. You're going to find individuals out there. But those who encourage them are at least as responsible as the trolls.
But okay, on the other hand, Milo used his real name. I mean, you can ban him because it's him. none of those other people, I'm sure, were using their real names and could be effectively banned because they just create a new account.
Though you know that Twitter, since you have trolls.
Structurally, Twitter cannot.
Twitter could do a far better job. There's patterns. They don't hook up to it. There was one troll that came after us. Like, God, I'm sorry. I don't even say this because he may come back. But would come after us 10 times in a day, 20 times in a day. And there's a pattern. And Twitter can be smart enough.
Structurally, this is a problem. I think the only solution, if you wanted to get rid of this, is to force people to use the real names.
No,
which Twitter can't do and will never do.
As I always say, I can tell you a-holes by name. Anonymity is not, yes, anonymity is the cloak of the coward.
But that's the problem is if you're anonymous, you cannot block them. They just create
it's not
a new
about
account.
Anonymity. It's so no, it's not. here's the problem. So first of all, I really kind of disagree with and I actually went back and forth with Kara Swisher and a few others about this particular issue.
Milo's banning?
It smells to me like Twitter is doing what Facebook is always doing, which Facebook kind of. And I don't mean to overly exaggerate or overly criticize, but Facebook generally seems to have no ethics. They try things, and if they get burned in public opinion, they apologize and they stop and they go try something else. And Twitter has not always been like that. They've been kind of a free speech fundamentalist in certain ways. They have their own system, which is deeply flawed, and I can get into that in a sec. But basically, they did what they did purely because of the PR. They essentially said that Milo... was targeted harassment. Well, we both know that half the people on this panel have multiple Twitter accounts where the whole account is all about targeted harassment of people on this.
They're not our accounts. Right. Other people's accounts. Yeah.
But my point is that the whole purpose of the account, I mean, Milo's purpose of his account was not just to harass Leslie Jones.
He's himself.
He's himself, and he's a trollish affect
in the day
in
he,
all
he attacked me. Milo attacked me at length. And then when his publication went bankrupt, he became for a brief while humble and nice and kind of okay and a little bit contrite, but then went back to his...
But
he's
doing
his whole shtick.
At least he's not anonymous. It's ironic that because he's not anonymous, he can be banned.
Right.
And he has the courage to use his own name. His handle is at Nero, but he uses his own name.
And using the word courage in this case puts you in Bill Maher territory from... politically incorrect.
Well, he's more courageous than the trolls who don't use their real names.
Yeah, fine. And
I mean, if you're going to troll,
that gains you what?
At least use your real name because then you're standing behind your statements.
Well, but Twitter, no. Let me try it this way, Leo. Twitter bans thousands upon thousands upon thousands of egg accounts. This one just happens to have a name. If they ban the thousands of accounts that don't have a real name, then why should one that does have a real name be treated any differently if the behavior is equally heinous in Twitter's rules?
But it isn't. It isn't equal. I mean, I think to a very large extent, they banned Milo because he influenced other people to do super horrible things.
That's a heinous behavior in my book.
Well, I mean, I've been acute. Like, for example, I've let's say 4 years ago, I would be defending Google Plus and criticizing a writer who got a whole bunch of things wrong about Google Plus, and then a whole bunch of Google Plus fundamentalist fanatics went after that writer with all kind of vitriol and stuff that I didn't want them to do, and I specifically asked them not to, but they did it as sort of like they felt encouraged by what I had done, and that's not the case with Milo. He's a foul person. He's like a professional provocateur. He loves the reaction. He loves to get people outraged.
I think with all trolls, only speculate, but I think that's part of the payoff, right?
Right. But the problem with Twitter is that they don't have clear guidelines. I mean, for example, I'm bothered by trolls who set up an account where the sole purpose of that account is to attack a single person. That should be something that can be established and measured.
Okay,
and
as somebody who is the target of such continual attacks,
exactly.
I don't think they can. The person, it's not particularly difficult to use tools that obfuscate your account. And so you just create a new email account.
Should be hard. It should take time to do that, and it should be harder to do.
Yeah, but some people are motivated to spend the time. It's I'm sure much easier for us to block him than it is for him to create the account, but it doesn't seem to deter him.
The biggest problem is that Twitter is like Pokemon Go. The content is just out there. And so on Facebook or Google Plus or other social networks, you start a conversation. You, Leo Laporte, start a conversation. And then it's like, okay, this is the space where we're talking about Leo Laporte stuff. And then people add comments to your posts. And when somebody's a troll, you block their, you delete their comment. You delete their reply. You block them from participating in any future comments under your posts. On Twitter, that doesn't happen. When you block somebody on Twitter, when you block somebody on Facebook or Google Plus, they leave the room. When you block somebody on Twitter, you leave the room.
Right.
Right.
And that's Twitter's solution is, mute or block them, and then they won't bother you. And the reason I don't do that is because then they're continuing to do it, and everybody else sees it. I don't see it. That doesn't solve the problem.
Right. Twitter puts themselves in the pop role. They need to empower users to be able to take action against people who are infiltrating their community, infiltrating their conversations. You need to be able to own your conversations on Twitter like you can on Facebook and elsewhere, and then have some control, some moderation control. And that would make a huge difference.
So I want to understand this because my attitude has been basically there's nothing that can be done. This is the nature of Twitter. And Twitter, you know, made their bed when they created it. And of course, they didn't know what they were getting into, so I don't blame them. But the way they've structured it, it's not possible to fix this problem. I just want to hear. I want Mike to explain it. I know he did, but I want to understand it. What is the simple fix that would fix this? That Facebook does, for instance, is a new kind of blocking.
Well, verification comes in. If everyone can be verified,
removes anonymity for Twitter.
Hold on. Okay. If everyone can be verified, you can choose to look at only the verified.
Well, I can do that now.
Well, but that's a tiny, tiny, tiny group of celebrities. That means celebrities,
They just announced that.
That's what I'm saying. Yes. That's what I'm saying. So I can see the beginnings of a strategy that says, okay, there's two Twitters. There's a verified real name Twitter, which they're going to presume is higher civility, and then there's Twitter.
Solve this problem. Let me give you this problem, and I'd love to hear how Twitter could solve this problem. So there's a fella who targets me with really vile stuff, and then at the same time tweets sponsors and future guests with vile stuff, trying to discourage them from buying. He's basically trying to put us out of business, single-handedly trying to put us out of business. What's the fix for that? Obviously, me blocking him doesn't fix it because the sponsors
Twitter
and future
should have
guests.
Structures to know
and by the
way,
I think
does.
You all know who I'm talking about because I know he's tweeted all of you.
Exactly.
And, by the way, Virginia Heffernan almost didn't come on because she was told that I was a sexist pig and likely to ambush interview her. And she was girded. She said, I'm ready. And she had a lot of responses to my sexist pig, my potential sexist pig comments to her. So, I mean,
you know, if Twitter cared enough,
how do you fix that?
When I block that person and I always report them to Twitter, I do Twitter the favor of reporting them, right? Mm-hmm. There are clear patterns, clear and easy patterns that would allow Twitter to put a flag on some account before it gets started and starts doing this.
What's interesting. Okay. First of all, the guy's fairly sophisticated. He has one account that he knows will get blocked each time because it's clearly offensive. So
do you know who it is?
No, you can't because he's smart enough to remain anonymous. And then he has a second account, which never crosses the line. We can't block because it's parody account. You know about that, Jeff, because of your parody account.
Oh, yeah.
So he never crosses the line. So he can't be blocked. And he's smart enough to have both of those because it's very effective. He can attack us on two fronts.
But Twitter should be saying, let's just say that he uses the same IP address. He's smart enough probably not.
He does not use the same IP address. He obfuscates his identity entirely.
Once. If you could prove once that the guy who does all these horrid things and gets blocked is the same guy who does that, what you say. If you're banning for life, you're banning for life in all forms.
But you can't ban him if he uses a different IP address and email each time.
There are patterns.
Let me hear Mike's fix. I want to hear Mike's structural fix.
Okay, there are multiple things. So normal social networks like Facebook and Google Plus and others do a combination of they delete accounts when they violate certain guidelines. And the question is, what are those guidelines? And then they also let you delete comments to people who have commented on your stuff. And you can block people from ever commenting on your stuff again. And those are both very powerful. In the case of you and your troll, and Jeff, you and your troll, they're, in my opinion, stepping over the line. So, for example, the professor that shall not be named is clearly, it's not a legitimate parody account because the name that he uses is exactly what would be legitimately used to refer to you. And so that right there should be like, that is not parody. That's somebody who's trying to confuse and obfuscate, and boom, out he goes. Amen, in case brother. Of you, Leo, you know, this is a person who's clearly targeting you personally, your business, your guests. It's so clear. And obviously there should be clear rules. It'd be easy to write. I'd be happy to write them. It'd take me 20 minutes that would identify that kind of line crossing, and boom, they'd gone. It should also take some time. You should have to rise like Pokemon Go, like levels to the point where you are trusted in certain ways. And I don't know how to exactly structure that. So that's that set of problem.
But no, but it doesn't solve it because he comes in each time under a different he's not identifiable.
But the pattern of what he says is clear.
Well, now you're asking for some sophisticated. And what do you want Twitter to run?
Scaling that to 300 million users.
You want Twitter to do semantic analysis on each new account and say, this
you don't
is
have
the same?
To scale it. Because if not you make each user a moderator of their own site, essentially, then Twitter doesn't have to do it all. They don't have to be omnipresent.
Twitter's never going to do this. B, they don't want to do it. And it's,
we should all leave Twitter.
Well, I would love to, but so here's another problem. I could leave Twitter, but if they don't and they continue to do that, then what have I gained? It's the same thing as muting them. I'm not seeing it.
But could you file a lawsuit? And then
against whom?
Well, so that's have to go through probably Twitter or
you can't, because I can tell you right now, I haven't checked, but I'm sure he's using Tor and other anonymizing technologies that would prevent any subpoena from being. I have done this, by the way. Some years ago, somebody tweeted a rape threat and a murder and rape threat against my daughter, my underage daughter. And we went to the local police, and because, you know, that's, by the way, the only time the police get involved is if there's a legitimate fear for your safety. You know, you have to have a death threat. Then
they won't always get involved.
And they won't always. We were very lucky. We had a local police officer here in Petaluma who agreed to pursue it. He got a court order, went to Twitter, because I asked Ev. I said, Ev, you're a father of a daughter. This guy did this. Ev wouldn't. And I understand why. He's not going to set a precedent. He's not going to do me a favor. So we went to the police. The police did get the subpoena. What they got was the IP address from Twitter. They then had to figure out who the ISP was, get another subpoena in that jurisdiction. That required him going to the Chicago police and convincing them to get a subpoena from a judge in that jurisdiction to the ISP to say whose account is, who is this IP address. They tracked it down. It was a young boy, 15-year-old boy, unprosecutable. So the Chicago police knocked on his door and said, told his dad, and his dad yelled at him, and that it was the end of that. First of all, a lot of effort, very low potential for success. It did succeed, and there you have it. Now, the best I can hope for is maybe that kid is not going to be a stalker and a abuser in his future life. Maybe we nipped it in the bud.
This actually is a really... This is one reason why people should speak up against harassers or showcase these things, because
what if the person, by the way, lives in another country, which I believe he does?
That is an issue, but it helps strengthen our laws in the physical world around harassment, which are fairly weak. So if you think about your experience in that, you know, imagine if you weren't lucky that way. And honestly, physical harassment is just as difficult, not just
That's
as.
That's right. It's very
can
difficult.
Be as difficult.
That's right.
So it's important to say, hey, this is an issue. It's important for people like you to say this is an issue so we can fix it. Maybe not just at Twitter, but like your police officers should not have to, you know, there should be something to help them do something like that across state lines so you don't have to actually visit Chicago or.
But there isn't. None of this exists. None of this is ever likely to exist.
So let me ask you this.
I don't want to show you this. And if you're easily offended, hide your eyes. You don't want to show it?
I don't want to show it.
Okay, because he just tweeted. Of course, they love the attention. And normally I don't talk about it because why, you know, I don't need to feed the beast. It's an issue. I think it's intractable. I don't think it's insolvable. I think as long as something like Twitter exists that allows now, one thing that may be worth a conversation is should an anonymity be allowed ever?
Yes. It is necessary for the harassed themselves.
Then you're going to have this no matter what. Then this is going to
exist. Okay, well, let me try the question a different way. If you own Twitter and you're a responsible person, would you do anything differently?
Well, that's what I'm asking.
Absolutely. I like the level up scheme. I really like, I haven't thought this through, but I like the idea of giving people different levels of trust, maybe different circles. And I don't want to call it circles of trust. That sounds so.
But our sponsors, when they get tweeted at, we instruct them, okay, check how long it's been around, how many followers there are. You see, nobody saw this. One of our sponsors wanted to put out a press release.
Jeez.
And we said, you know, no one has seen this until you put out a press release. So,
Streisand effect.
Yeah. But so there's you're sophisticated, Stacey, and you would understand some sort of, you know, karma points thing. But most people, I mean, there is a karma points thing. How long has that account been around? How many followers do they have? What are the other tweets? You could easily look at that and go, oh, well, that's obviously a bogus account. People don't. And even sophisticated people like Virginia Heffernan don't.
My students, we have this conversation. My students say,
what do they say?
When I have my case, ignore it. It exposes them. They're out there. There's nothing you can do. I just find that too sad.
I mean, that's my attitude as well.
I don't think it's that complicated. It's just you should be able to, when you block somebody, they should no longer be able to @mention you. They should no longer be able to use a hashtag that uses your name.
Okay, but they could still tweet my sponsor with my real name.
Right, but you should be able to demonstrate that that you've blocked them.
Well, we do, and that's how what we have. But what it means is we have to call the sponsor, or they'll call us and say, to understand this is Twitter. People don't know this about Twitter. Even sophisticated people who ought to know better don't know this about Twitter. They think it's Twitter. It's great.
Maybe it's something that people will have to learn over time. Maybe it's a generational thing. I don't know. I know that my daughter is, even at 9, is far more sophisticated than I would imagine her to be.
Battle Cam in our chat room saying something I completely agree with. He said the same mechanism people use to attack others is used on a daily basis to get a company's attention. And I would submit getting a company's attention for a problem by a legitimate person happens far more than using it as abuse. And I would agree. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's why Twitter is valuable, because it's most of the time used in a very valuable way. We wouldn't want to lose it. But I think structurally and endemically, it has a flaw that is never going to go away.
Yeah.
Is that openness? And the further event is openness has that flaw, period.
So back to
the tragedy
banning,
of the Twitter.
Back to banning Milo. Yeah, the tragedy of the Twitter comments. Exactly. Yeah. Back to banning Milo Yiannopoulos. Is that the right thing to do? Is it curtailing free speech? In my opinion, I mean, he's a vile, horrible thing what he's doing, but he's doing it under his real name,
Twitter has a right to say what goes out under its brand.
Of course they can.
I wish Twitter had higher standards. And so that's not a matter of free speech. That's a matter of Twitter having its own speech. Twitter also has a right to edit. Magazines have a right to edit. They shouldn't be forced to publish things they don't want to publish. And that's what they're doing in this case. Stacey, sorry.
No, I'm thinking this through.
Oh, that's rare for this show. I mean, we never do that.
I know. I'm terrible at that. So you can't incite a riot. This is where laws are country specific. If you built standards that kind of talked about inciting other people to harass versus saying vile, stupid things that you just think, maybe that's a way to get around. Maybe that's when you ban someone like Milo, who is, you know, who does have a right to free speech. But when does it cross the line to I guess yelling fire in a crowded theater, that's actually not the right analogy.
He doesn't have a right to free speech on Twitter. He has no right to say what he wants
Twitter
to on Twitter.
Twitter feels
that's
like
a right.
It's a platform for free speech. If Twitter, as a commercial entity that owns the platform, decides that's a right they want to enforce or decides to quote-unquote make it a right, then he has it. I mean, that's kind of what we're arguing, is how Twitter creates rights or...
Well, but Twitter has standards, right? And so Twitter set a line of a standard. Now, I think what Leo's saying is, does that line make any sense? Because what they did was ban somebody who put his name on versus a million people who don't.
They don't really have standards, because essentially they have standards, and then they essentially banned Milo, who has done things. You know, there are far worse people that they don't ban. They banned him because it was a PR problem.
And they banned him because they could ban him. They can't ban the people who are anonymous.
The solution is not to silence people. It's to marginalize them. The problem is that a troll can have as much attention as the celebrity themselves, especially when celebrities are retweeting them. But the solution is to marginalize through just tweaking the system as it exists. So I think all you really need to do is have a system that sort of pushes pushes people out to the wilderness if they're like sort of objectionable to the people who they're talking about. Right. So that already exists on most other social networks. It's not that complicated. And I think Twitter could easily do it.
Why don't they?
Because it changes something that's unique about Twitter.
Every time I block this guy, I provide them with all the previous handles. If they really wanted to, they could, in fact, have. There's a very concrete pattern. He's actually just repeats the same tweets over and over again. So
what if they charge you for more accounts? I guess you just start a new email account. Never mind. If you're really dedicated, you're going to get through it.
That's the real problem.
Somebody who's really like this is so dedicated. Oh. I don't know. It's like, that's the question. It's like, you're spending so much more time on this. I don't understand why. It just like baffles me. It's just bizarre.
So we shouldn't use him as our.
But there's many hims. You shouldn't use me as an example. There are many, many, many people like this, apparently. For instance, I'm seeing a lot of hashtag free Milo stuff. And it's, you know, by the way, this is oddly conflated with Gamergate. I don't understand.
Yes. Oh, because Milo had opinions about Gamergate, and you can imagine what they were.
Yeah. Apparently, some of the same people with Gamergate don't want a female cast Ghostbusters. What is so sacred about Ghostbusters? It can't be remade. Every other movie in the world, including the first Star Wars, which is essentially remade by the newest Star Wars, has been remade. I don't get people's obsessions. I think what partly this is that these people have always, I would guess, have always existed, but never had a platform. So we just haven't been that aware of them. They've been
and we make the mistake of encouraging them. Fight. That happens all too much.
Well, and that's usually why I'm breaking my absolute rule mentioning this at all. But I mean,
I just put up a piece in the chat or in the rundown chat from Addie Robertson at The Verge, who argues that the problem is that Twitter is being vague about this. This is also a matter of standards. And we don't know what those standards are. I think Facebook does a okay job of setting standards. You know, no matter what, no naked breasts. Well, except for breastfeeding. But otherwise, no. Well, except for post-operative. But otherwise, no. Right? But they do set a line. They try to do things around live and so on and so forth. They try to set lines so that they can point to those lines. The problem that Addie Robertson has here is that Twitter's vague about this. They're not saying what the standard was or how can we enforce this in the future or what is it about Milo? And I think that's a decent point.
Selective enforcement is always a problem for instance, as a parent, I know this as a parent, if you punish some behavior but not others, it confuses the hell out of your kids.
And I think, Jeff, you give Facebook way too much credit. In those cases you specified, those policies were created as and only as the direct result of bad PR. That's the only thing that caused those policies. They just plow forward.
Let's not call it bad PR. Let's call it, you know, feedback from the community. People complained about it, and then
otherwise it wouldn't be bad PR, right?
That's why this is so difficult, incidentally, because it is free speech, right? people should have the right to complain, even if you disagree. And Milo should have the right for to have his bizarre political beliefs, even if you disagree. And he should be allowed to have that.
Twitter does have the right not to host
it. No, I understand. The free speech in the sense of government shall not make a law to restrict speech.
This is true free speech, but
we live in a world where we kind of want to encourage people to be able to speak freely, even if their opinions diverge from ours. It's different. I'm not talking about the First Amendment style free speech, but just the general notion.
But think of it in terms of we have our home. We have so Jeff is a New York socialite, the belle of the ball, and has these massive cocktail parties that are just everybody's talking about them all the time. And he has the right to invite who he wants into his living room to have these cocktail parties, and the right to, next time he has one, to not invite that person because they got drunk and they tripped over the couch and all that kind of stuff. So next time he doesn't have to invite them. And everybody supports his right to do that. I think that social networks should be like a cocktail party. You should have the right to create one space on the whole of the internet that's just yours, and you can interact with just the people you want to interact with. And anybody who, if you're a semi-public figure or a public figure or a celebrity or famous like Jeff Jarvis, you should be able to carve out this space and say, okay, you know what? You're not invited. Out you go. And so that when people want to interfere with you and your community, they can only really do it from inside your cocktail party, inside of your little space. In Twitter, there is no little space. We're all outside, wandering around like Pokemon Go players, clawing and scratching at each other with no control over who is at our cocktail party. It's like having a cocktail party where the law requires anyone can come.
I think you should start that business.
Google did, but nobody wanted it.
Oh, well, then there we go.
Well played, sir. Well played. Are you still using Google Plus, Mike?
I do. It's getting weird because the sort of English-speaking, you know, originally it was kind of an elite site for very brainy people who were super enthusiastic about what they're doing. And little by little, some of those people are wandering away. But meanwhile, lots and lots of other people who don't speak English so well, are not really aware of what's going on, don't really want to have conversations about what you post, are creeping in. So it's a very active site, but the nature of the conversation is getting weird.
Yeah.
You know, I post a picture of like a loaf of bread. I'm like, oh, look at this great bread.
Oh, it's beautiful too. I wanted it. Yeah.
Three or four people, five people, 10 people reply with, what is this? It's a loaf of bread.
Have you never seen bread? Maybe they haven't. Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who post comments that it's clear that they can't see the post or the photo. So they're like,
I think there's some bots, Mike. I think there's some strange bots that are there. Every time there's a photo, what probably threw me off was every time there was a photo there, you got, 30 posts from Asia just saying, oh, wow. Oh, how nice. And
yeah.
There's no API, though. Why? How would this work?
I don't know. There's a certain type of Vietnamese post that uses 5 or 6 words from your post and then trails off into Vietnamese.
Here's the bread. Does that not look good?
Does it not look like bread? Like who in the world would not say, oh, that's loaf of bread?
So Van Tung Pham says WTOP. I don't even know what that is.
Where are you located?
Yeah. Michael Holland says hello.
Charles, and again, these are blue heads. Like, look at how many people don't have a
profile. Charles Cockadoodle-Doo.
He's making, right, so that's what it's become.
And where are you located?
I go through the notifications feature, and a post from like 3 years ago will surface, and it has like 600, you know, it has like 450 comments and 13,000 plus ones, and I'm like, boy, those are the days.
Well, by the way, Twitter has a similar problem because if you look at your mentions where people have mentioned you, favored you, retweeted you. Bizarre old tweets of mine are, you know, it's filled with bots, usually attractive women in low-cut dresses favoriting or retweeting old tweets of mine.
I have this horrible thing, Leo. There's some services that I'm not seeing right now with the put up. Yeah, I've got one right here. I some time ago I said the first step to blogging is not writing them but reading them. So somebody made that into a GIF. And it's not always purely fake accounts, but it's BS accounts. And I see this thing popping up 10 times a day. 2 or 3 of these quotes pop up. There's clearly no reason for them. They're not really quoting me. They're trying to prove to somebody's algorithm that they're real by seeming to have content. and then they do other things.
Right. It's that's the only thing I can figure out. Actually, in the case of these women, I think they just want people to see the avatar. And
they're not women, Leo.
I'm sorry.
I was going to say, Leo, I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry to disappoint you, Leo.
What? But they're so cute. And then if you look at their Twitter stream, it's like, go to our site and see our stuff and that kind of stuff. It's spam.
Okay. They got you to click.
Yeah. Well, only because they, was that the whole goal, is to get me to click?
Yes, you.
It's confusing.
I mean, it's pretty onesie-twosie. That's, talk about retail spam. I mean, that's a lot of work to get me to click. Maybe that's what they're doing. All right, let's take a break. I'm very curious what Jeff Jarvis has to say. We've been fighting back and forth over Google AMP. Now AMP is amping ads. Now I really wonder what Jeff Jarvis thinks about Google AMP.
I'll be curious what you have to say, sir.
Well, at least they're speedy. Our show today brought... These ads are not, however. Our show today brought to you by Wealthfront. I love Wealthfront. Wealthfront solves a problem everybody has or should have, which is, if you're saving for the long term, your retirement, college fund, buying a house, rainy day fund, you got to invest it. You can't just put it in a mattress. You got to invest it. But how are you going to do that? Are you going to keep track of it, learn all you need to do to learn and rebalance and monitor it regularly? Or you probably not, right? Or you're going to go to an advisor and he'll take 1, 2, or 3% of what you've got under investment right off the top every year, not to mention hidden fees, transaction costs. It's very hard to make any money that way. So we got a better way. And it's a computer doing the work on your behalf. That's why it's cheap. Instead of 1 or 2 or 3%, Wealthfront charges 0.25% a year, 25 basis points a year, with never any additional fees, any transaction fees, any hidden fees. That's all it costs. That's less than $5 a month investing a $30,000 account. And do they pay attention to your account? Yes, they do. Every minute of every day, Wealthfront is rebalancing, doing things like tax loss harvesting to maximize your return and minimize your tax. It's incredible. And, of course, you know exactly what it's doing at all times. You can view and track all your accounts in one place, even accounts that aren't Wealthfront accounts. So you can see your whole net worth on the Wealthfront site or using the Wealthfront app. Every trade is on your dashboard. It's amazing. And it's based on the best research, the smartest minds. So it really, really works. They recently introduced their 529 college savings plan, which lets you invest after-tax dollars. It's kind of like a Roth IRA, basically. So if you're saving for a child or grandchild's higher expenses, you want to save and you want to get the best return at the lowest cost, Wealthfront. Now, I'm not saying go there and sign up right away. I want you to go there and research it and read it. You owe it to yourself and to your money. But go to wealthfront.com/twig. One way that you can learn about it is they'll go through the question process. It's very few questions to determine your time frame and your risk aversion. And they'll generate a free personalized investment portfolio. That's yours to keep. It's free. They'll also, if you want, they can look at your other accounts and say how much you're spending in fees, how you could minimize taxes on it, how diversified your investments are. It's really, I mean, just think of it as a financial checkup. And that's free. Read up on Wealthfront. And you can get started if you decide to invest. You can get started for as little as $500. That's the minimum investment. And I really like this because it's a great way to get a nest egg going. Your first $15,000 will be free of charge, not 0.25%, but zero forever. Forever. That's nice. Wealthfront.com/twig. I hear from a lot of people using Wealthfront who are very, very happy. Find out more. Wealthfront.com/twig.
Can I add kind of a slightly related thing to the Milo story in terms of having fake people?
Yeah.
And just John Green just put up a post saying this is one of the weirdest things in a while. Now there's a lot of speculation that Meredith McIver, the Melania speechwriter, is not real.
What?
Yeah. I just put it up.
No, that can't be.
Wow. That's awesome.
So I had a theory worthy of Mike Elgin. Because we're watching Melania speak. And by the way, not a knock on Melania in any way. I feel very sorry for her. She just, this is not her fault. But I'm watching and she says, Donald is never going to give you up. He's never going to let you down. And I turned to Lisa and said, she just Rickrolled us. She said, what? She just Rickrolled us. Yeah. And then, and I didn't catch the plagiarism. Of course, I heard about it the next day. But then I realized my theory was that a Dick Tuck, remember Dick Tuck? I'm sure you do, Jeff Jarvis.
Oh, yeah.
The
yeah.
Democratic prankster.
Prankster, right.
Who got a number of pregnant African-American women to hold up the Nixon the One signs. Nixon's the One signs during the Nixon... Right. He was famous and he was puckish. He was not he was a dirty trickster, but in a kind of humorous vein for Humphrey, I guess it was in 1968. Anyway, I thought, you know what? Some Dick Tuck style guy wrote this knowing that Melania wouldn't know and would just read it. So
it was
now
the troll of the year, maybe.
What? I mean, talk about a great troll. But anyway,
troll?
That was
That's
my
just fun.
That was my theory. I don't know what now. So then just this morning, they finally said, oh, no, you know what? There's a woman who's written some stuff for Donald in the past. Melania was uncomfortable with the speech that was written for her by professional speechwriters. So she called this woman up and said, help me write this speech. The woman said, OK, well, what? Tell me some speeches you were impressed by. What the kind of thing you'd like to say? And Melania told her about Michelle Obama's 2008 convention speech. She said, I like this one. And somehow text from that inadvertently, and I believe that, inadvertently got into the text of the speech. Although they're never going to give you up, never going to let you down. I'm still like, that is definitely a Rickroll.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that seems... kind of trollish. When Donald Trump was introducing the VP candidate, and of course there were rumors that he had last minute cold feet and kind of regretted the decision. They were playing the Rolling Stones. You can't get what you want.
What? Like before he announced his vice presidential candidate, the theme song is "You can't always get what you want."
Yeah,
but if you try sometime, you'll get what you need.
I want to believe that somebody is trolling.
I think there are some disaffected campaign workers is what I think. But anyway.
Yeah.
So now the latest is that this woman doesn't exist.
So the independent, I put them both up at the bottom
can't
of the rundown.
That can't be true.
Donald did pretend to be his own.
Exactly.
His own PR dude.
And they said they're not going to fire Meredith MacIver.
Because he can't fire a ghost.
And where is a picture of Meredith MacIver?
Oh, there's a picture there. Now, Piers Morgan just came on Twitter saying that he'd dealt with her many times over the years.
Okay. I would.
I've got one. I don't know.
There's nothing too bizarre in this bizarre election cycle, but that one maybe is a little far.
Yeah. Yeah. So John Green said, you know, John Green, the wonderful VidCon John Green, this Meredith MacIver possibly not existing thing is, even by the standards of 2006 American political discourse, intensely weird.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. It's, if nothing else, it's enjoyable.
Yeah.
Unless the worst happens. And you know what? I have to be careful here because even some of our employees are Trump supporters. So, and I'm happily married to a Republican, which I never thought I would be. But you know what? That has opened my mind. No. And I want to say this. Yeah. That's opened my mind to the possibility that everything I hold dear is wrong.
So I had a moment with God this week. I was down. It was kind of a rough week, but moving my parents into the retirement continuing care, and that's a whole other story. And we're gonna get to Frontier Communications.
Oh man!
So one of the things I had a whole list of to dos. One of the things I did was change their forwarding address to the post office. And you go on now, and there's some service the post office sends you to that tries to send you all kinds of ads. They're trying to make money on this basic government function, whatever. After it finishes with the address forwarding, it says, well, you really need to update your voter registration. Do you want to do that?
Nice.
I faced God eye to eye because my parents are both Fox News watching.
Oh, should you register them?
And I said,
Oh.
Oh. I did it. I registered.
Good man.
I did. But, the election could be my fault.
My parents are the same way, Jeff. And
That's okay.
I volunteered if I needed to drive my parents to the polling.
Good.
Oh. And run out of gas on the way. Oh, I tried.
My Tesla just ran out of power.
No.
Stupid green machine.
Oh, you see, we need more oil. If they'd only approve that pipeline.
There you go. Okay, can we not talk about politics anymore?
I know. I always resist it, but it's so hard not to because...
Well, I get in such trouble afterwards.
It's so fascinating.
You're a journalist. You should have absolutely no opinions. You're disgusting.
There's also a technology and social media dimension, which is hard to avoid when you're talking about technology.
Well, and that's my... Some would say rationalization. Some would say rationale. I do feel like this is really an internet election in a great degree. And you can very much say that Mr. Trump's success stems from his ability to directly address an audience in the internet era in a way that no prior candidate has been able to. He mastered the medium.
Yeah. I think also that the internet has helped completely fragment us a lot more. And that also helps him play to extremes both sides, really.
And the thing I have to remind myself is maybe he's playing to extremes, maybe he's not my candidate, but he got a lot of votes. And
Bernie Sanders versus Trump.
Well, and the same thing with Sanders. And there's a reason, there's somebody, that's of somebody's voice, somebody's opinion, and I have to acknowledge it.
So two things about this, Leo. Number one, I would say a lot is relative. 13 million people out of 350 million people is not a lot of Americans who actually went to the trouble of voting for that candidate.
Right. Well, we'll see. What it'll be telling is the general, of course.
The problem we have, and I've done this spiel a little bit before, where I think we're at the end of the mass media business model, which means we're at the end of the notion of the mass. But we have institutions that depend upon the idea of the mass.
Like political parties. Yeah.
There's two parties, and we're all going to be clumped into one of two of them. Nope. And then we're going to battle it out, and we'll come up with some compromise that's okay. Well, now 13 million Americans could come along and utterly take over, insurgently take over one of those two institutions. And they used brilliantly the tools now at hand to do so. And used everything legally and above board and the way it is. And they used the system. The system wasn't rigged. They managed to use that system to do that. And so the institutions that depended upon this idea of the mass are now challenged because you don't have to be as big as the mass to take over. You just got to be smarter about the tools for now.
Should we be parliamentary democracy?
It has its own weakness.
We should vote based on our principles. I know that's never going to happen, but right now we vote based on the person who can defeat the person we hate. Something like 55% of people who are voting for Trump are doing so because they want to vote against Hillary Clinton.
Right.
Only 35% or something like that actually want Trump to be president. 55% just don't want Hillary Clinton to be president. Likewise, on the other side, a lot of people are going to vote Democrat because they don't want Donald Trump to be the election.
That's the nature of a two-party system.
There are three parties on the ballot in all 50 states.
Yeah.
And there should be four. Bernie Sanders should have run on socialist.
Oh, please ticket. No.
Gary
please
Johnson. No. Yes. But Gary Johnson should have divided the right vote. He should have. Bernie Sanders should have divided the left vote, and we'd have at least four. There should actually be a dozen or more people on the ballot in all 50 states.
Look how well that's working in Great Britain.
Yeah.
England has a prime minister no one elected.
and a head of labor nobody likes.
Right. And a foreign minister that hates other countries.
I like our presidential system, but it would work a lot better if people voted according to the candidate that they want, instead of the person who they think could defeat the candidate they don't want.
I have to say, maybe I'm a stick of my head in the sand, but I said this yesterday too, I think that our founding fathers were very smart. I think they created an amazingly successful form of government that has stood the test of time, that there have been times as fragmented and as challenging as this many times in our democracy. We don't really remember them but they have been, and we've survived in each case. And I think we'll survive in this case. And I think it works pretty darn well. It's not perfect, of course, but I have faith in it.
I have faith in the founding fathers as well, but the founding fathers never envisioned party conventions. They never envisioned, George Washington specifically said, watch out for political parties. You don't want to get involved in these political. Yeah. So I think it's kind of, the problems are not founding father problems. They're simply things that we've invented lately that
I think we'll transcend those. I think we'll transcend those. And I think that checks and balances, the three branches of government, the interesting, the electoral college, the interesting kind of non-representative, but the representative as opposed to truly democratic system. I think all of these things, I think, are self-healing. And I think they'll work. I think that we will do fine. But
I hope so.
I hope I'm right.
I'm
a starry-eyed optimist. We don't. Look at no empire lasts forever.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think this notion of institutional challenge, this institutional revolution, is profound, and there are institutions, political parties, labor unions, universities, post office, you know, all kinds of institutions in society that are now challenged, and look at newspapers, right? Newspapers are trying to preserve themselves in some form. Well, maybe they all do need to go, and something replaces them. Libraries.
We're in exciting times, right? And we're in disruptive times. And I think that's not unusual. And I think equilibrium eventually is achieved. Unfortunately, these interregnums are often, sad to say, a lot of people get hurt. A lot of people lose jobs. A lot of people lose not just their livelihood, but their lives. And that's the nature of the way human society progresses.
Let me say this without. Please don't get mad at me, people. I'm making this for illustration. Okay. Would you just listen for one second? I'm not saying what I'm about to say. But if trolls can take over Twitter, they can take over the political system.
Well, that's an interesting question. Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Right. If you have an open political system, and Mike, the disagreement I have with you is that yes, on one hand, we should have four parties, six parties, but it doesn't work with a Congress that is then built around two parties.
We do have those parties.
Mike Bloomberg,
we actually do have them.
Mike Bloomberg has said, why didn't he run? Because he said, number one, I couldn't get into either party. So then if I run as an independent, let's say I win, but I have absolutely no backing from anything. Nothing's ever going to happen in Congress.
wouldn't be the first time.
The only reason we have two parties is because of the money. If you took the money out of politics, there would be many, many parties. And I think our democracy would function a lot better. But I think that you mentioned like the trolls could steal an election. If they did steal an election, and now back to technology, they'd have to steal it from the bots, because I think bots are the ones who really are controlling this election in a scary way that people haven't really come to terms with. So much of the influence of political discourse online on social media is actually automated AstroTurf bots that are really, really more influential than people realize.
Wow.
Wasn't that a plot thread?
Just for the record.
Go ahead, Stacey.
No, wasn't that a plot thread on House of Cards? Or that was controlling search results?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. They tried to. Go ahead, Jeff.
Just for the record, Slate says they do have proof that Meredith MacIver exists.
That was
a short-lived moment.
That was a quick, brief moment.
Meredith is reassuring.
Kind of fun.
Wow, so that was like quality journalism for us right there.
So here's the question: is Ann Coulter a bot or a troll? It's not clear.
You're gonna get in trouble for that.
I know. Oh no! Really? Do you think Ann Coulter has any supporters left?
You'll find out.
You'd be surprised.
I don't care.
You'd be surprised.
Google looks to amp up mobile ads. New ad initiative builds on company's effort to speed up delivery of mobile web content. We've talked about Google Amp, a kind of stripped down version of the internet that is compatible with all browsers, intended for mobile browsing to speed up sites. Google has been encouraging internet publishers to offer both AMP and unamped sites, but of course encourage them to do the faster AMP sites. Some ad technology was allowed. Does it make sense for ads to be part of AMP?
Oh, absolutely. Because the problem is, because of the priority in which the content is served on AMP, you get the structure of the page, which is not allowed to change, so it can't jump around. You get the content. The ads will then box out, and then the ad will come into that box when it's good and ready. Well, so what's happening is the ads ain't getting served by the time you've seen the page.
Right.
So this, and Google's known this from the beginning, this is the hidden agenda here is to speed up not just web pages from content perspective, but speed them up from ads. Ads are what slow us down so much. So if your ads aren't seen, on the one hand, the advertiser can say, well, fine, I won't pay for it. It's not visible. But on the other hand, they are trying to buy ads and trying to get to people. And so speeding up ads is a critical piece of speeding up the web.
It's kind of stripping out that ugly ad tech that really is the real problem, frankly.
Yeah, there's various things about what you do, but I think that this is important, and it's going to be good for the advertisers in the end. We know from content, we've known right. for years, the faster the page, the more engagement and traffic you will get.
Mike, we lost your audio. I see you talking, but I see you talking.
That's my bad. I had it muted. So the other part of this that a lot of people aren't talking about is that this initiative also includes a landing page. What happens when you click on this fast ad, you get a fast page as a result of that, which makes advertising, greases the wheels of advertising, which I think is a good thing. I don't see what the harm is. And like you said, Leo, I think slow ads, bloated ads is a big part of the problem that's driving people to ad blockers, which, by the way, are now banned in China, I'm hearing. And so I think it's an unalloyed good. I don't see any downside to this at all.
Good. I feel much reassured.
That was the fastest AMP discussion we have ever had.
You know what? Is AMP getting traction? I see a lot of AMP stuff now.
I don't know.
I still think Google is not linking to it from enough places. I think it's from Google News and from the carousel and from a few other places, but I don't think the traffic is much yet.
Through Google now, does it go to an AMP page?
Good question, Stacey.
You mean like via voice?
No. just if I click on like a story from my Google Now page.
They're rolling it out bit by bit.
I see AMP articles on my Google Now. It has the little lightning bolt. Not all of them. But not all of them. Yeah,
do.
But I think I do see lightning bolts. Let me just check real quickly to make sure. But I seem to remember lightning bolts in my Google Now stories. By the way, I love Google Now. I don't know what Google's plans are.
They don't use it.
They don't really seem to have a long-term strategy.
Google Now should be their strategy.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's the anticipatory web right now on the screen. So I'm like, make it happen, man.
Do you use it all the time, Stacey?
I do. I love that it alerts me when there's traffic stuff. If I put in an address, what else do I use it for? All kinds of stuff. I love it. I open it whenever I'm in a place just to see like what's cool on the menu. Or I was in the cell phone lot at the airport and I opened that and it was like, hey, people who are at this spot, this location, they want to see this. And it handed me the arrival times of all the flights coming into the airport. And I was like,
yeah,
that's what I was going to search.
Yeah. Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
But I get kind of that stuff in Google Inbox, which is great. I see it showing up in various places in Google Keep and some of the Google Now stuff. I think that Google Now should come into its own. I don't know if it will when Google Home comes out, because I find personally that once I started using the Amazon Echo and Alexa, I almost completely stopped using Google Now and Siri.
Mm-hmm. When the hell are we going to get Google Home?
No one knows yet, but I would actually like Google Now on the Echo. I know that's sacrilege, blasphemy, whatever, but I would love it.
Well, I think you're going to. I think that's going to be what that little air freshener.
Yeah, but I don't want to buy the air freshener. I already have a bunch of cylinders.
Yeah, well, it's like me. I have like probably $4,000 or $5,000 worth of Sonos equipment.
Yeah, me too. Oh. Did you guys? That was me being excited.
That was so excited. Yes.
So this is a
Can I make that a ringtone?
Please. I want that ringtone.
This is such a common question. I have to tell people about it. So a company called J-Star.
You're just the greatest. Thank you, Stacey. I love you.
Okay. They showed a video for an Echo skill that is not yet approved that will let you control your Sonos from your Amazon Echo. Oh. So if you Google, it's a YouTube video from It's the company that does Josh AI, Josh.ai.
Oh, so it's not an official interface?
It's not approved yet. They've made the skill.
But it's not from Sonos?
It's not from Sonos.
Why not?
Because Sonos doesn't have their API put together yet. Anyway, there it is.
Third-party app Josh will bring a few new skills and different voices to Echo. That's interesting.
And the Sonos thing is kind of at the end, so the first part
is Josh like an alter? Like, is it Josh in the Echo? Is it in my Echo?
Josh is actually a home control with voice. Oh,
so it's not in my Echo.
No, it's a skill that they've developed, and they're just waiting for approval.
But it's an Echo skill.
They've designed it to be, but Amazon has to approve it.
So I'm saying things like ask Josh to play yes. Beyonce Lemonade on my Sonos.
On my Tesla, so I can control it.
Josh? Yeah, and that's the part of the Amazon Echo that doesn't work. We need artificial intelligence, and we need Alexa choosing the skill. If I have
you
to remember...
You've got to stop saying her name,
Michael. Yeah, Echo.
Yeah,
Echo.
Sorry. The
we just say Echo.
Virtual assistant that shall not be named.
Yeah.
That should be picking the skill, not me. I can't remember all of these commands.
Well, you can now. Yeah, I agree with you. And that's what Google and Apple are about to do, where they disintermediate. Yeah. They, or actually vice versa. They intermediate. They become your ombudsman and go out and get what you need. And they know what apps you have and they know what skills you need. And you just ask her. That's how Echo should be too, right?
Right.
Yeah, and Viv will be like that too, which is
right.
You know,
Viv.ai. How it's funny because until you get your Tesla, that you can't use the Tesla app. It says you don't have a Tesla.
Wow.
Oh.
Because
soup for you.
I know. I really want to use it, but
it's not that great.
How well integrated is your Tesla into your Sonos and everything else? It should be an IoT thing, right?
So there is a company, it's called, hold on, I think it's called Eve. Let me find it. They do an app through the Wink. And the last time I tried it, it was super high latency, so it didn't work as well. And then Tesla introduced some of the same functionality that I liked. But they have since revamped it, and I haven't tried it yet. I'm looking for it in my inbox, which is exciting. Here it is.
Eve Connect brings Wink
to
Tesla. That's Karsten. He's fast.
Yes. Eve Connect. He's faster than me typing.
He went to Harvard, you know.
Oh, fancy.
He won't say it, but I will.
What's he doing working in a slum like this?
Good question.
But yes, so that is an app that does that. And then I think Ford Sync is going to sync to the Echo, which will give you the smart home stuff.
Oh.
They announced that at CES, but I don't know if...
So you'll pull into the garage and it'll join the Wi-Fi.
Well, it does that anyway.
Does it?
The Tesla? Oh, yeah.
No, the Tesla does. Yeah, but...
Yes.
Yeah. Do you have autopilot?
No, I do not. Okay. I bought my Tesla used because I'm like...
You're smart.
I was going to go miserly of a sort.
Smart. Yeah, it's a pretty good deal to buy a used Tesla.
Oh, yeah. Well, so it's never a good idea to buy a new car. Buying a new car is the worst... It loses like 30% of its value when you drive off the lot.
The Teslas don't, but yes.
I'll find out on Friday.
There you go. Oh, your car's already lost value. They actually said they couldn't.
What?
They said they couldn't.
I haven't bought it yet.
Said they couldn't keep the pricing of the Model X. They couldn't guarantee it would hold up.
Oh, yeah. They used to guarantee that, right? The resale value. And they're not going to do that.
So
I think they're missing a big opportunity with that app. As somebody who's already got one coming, you should be able to use the app and communicate with your Tesla and say, what's going on? And your Tesla should say, they're putting the panel in on this.
Yeah. Even if they had a lie.
Cool.
Even if they said, right now I'm getting sprayed. It would be okay. I don't care.
Okay, well, they should make that up. Because the app, honestly, Leo, it's not that great.
Oh.
I'm going to tell you. It's
Android or iPhone better?
iPhone actually is better because it comes up faster.
I think I'm going to dedicate my iPhone to it's going to be like my Tesla phone.
It is creepy, though, because, you know, you can see where people are. There's a location section, so you can see the car driving around. And I'm like, oh, man. You know, my husband will log in and it'll be like, he no longer calls and asks me where I am.
Lisa's not going to like that. You mean I can see where Lisa is right now at any moment and vice versa?
If she was driving her Tesla and you had access to the app, yes. I don't think you can. Wow. Or ask somebody in the chat rooms because I have not been able to.
I'll be reporting back. I will tell you all. Let's see here. Nougat is very close. I have not gotten it yet on my Nexus. Have you, Nexus 6 P? But apparently Preview 5 is coming soon. Google released it earlier this week. Have you downloaded it?
I downloaded something yesterday.
That would be it then. Yeah.
That would be it. Okay.
And
there it was. I just had the message telling me to do something about this.
Mine did not get it, but are you on the developer preview?
Yeah.
Okay. Apparently, there's a new Easter egg in it. Do you want to try for the Easter egg?
Oh, no, I haven't restarted and installed. So
okay. Good, because this is ridiculous. It's
what is the Easter egg?
Oh, it's ridiculous. Okay. So, you know, if you press and hold. Okay, so you have to turn, you know, get the cartoon in, which means you go to About Phone, tap the Android version number like 6 times. You get a cartoon in. But press and hold the N and you get a small cat emoji underneath it. Tapping that again reveals a no entry emoji. Then swipe down your notification quick settings, tap edit, find the question mark Android Easter egg quick setting, drag it to your quick settings. After it's moved, tapping on the new empty dish quick setting toggle begins a game where you have to entice a cat to feed from an empty plate using either bits, fish, chicken, or treats.
Then tap on the get a life emoji.
Should a feline take the bait, which isn't guaranteed, you'll receive a notification with a cat and a number. Tapping on that reveals a new window with a smiling cartoon cat that, when long pressed, can be shared as an image.
This is why I carry an iPhone.
Is that somebody's 20% project? What's the deal with that?
Did they tell you this when they release it?
Somebody, find this? That's the question, is how did somebody at Android Central find this? Daniel Bader. Jeez.
Someone must have sent him an email. That's not an Easter
egg. Yes, Blake Bryant, it was his informant. He has 715 followers on Google+. He's a computer gaming nerd and apparently has a lot of free time.
Wow.
Here is something that worries me. Hangouts, the new version of Hangouts, no longer merges SMS messages with Hangout messages. In other words, you really don't want to use it as your SMS client anymore. You have to start using that other thing, Google Messenger.
This is part of Google's inexplicable policy of making almost everything that they offer work not as good as it used to.
Yeah,
This reminds me of Google Photos, which used to have amazing editing tools.
They took it out.
And now they're just lousy editing tools. So it's like, why did you do that?
And they still own the code, but they decided not to use it. So, Mike, are you using Fi in your travels?
Yes, I am. And in fact, this is my tool of the week.
I'll save it. That's coming up.
Save it because I want to know if I should get a Fi phone for my kid.
Okay, I will tell you.
Excellent.
Yay. Facebook is paying a lot of money to get internet stars to put their live video on Facebook, kind of wooing away the Vine stars.
So how much are they paying you, Leo?
Nothing. $2.2 million in payments intended to encourage experimentation on Facebook Live. Says Facebook. This isn't even a rumor. They pay a guy, John Paul Piquez, who is a Vine star. He does bawdy 6-second videos on Vine. $119,000 to use Facebook live streaming at least 5 times a month through September. Nice work if you can get it. Ray William Johnson's getting $250,000.
Are these all guys?
Yep.
Ooh, good boy.
They are all guys.
Are they all doing body humor, as it were?
Probably. I don't know.
I mean, Vine is a good place for that. I'm just thinking about like the demographic they're trying to go after.
That's interesting. I didn't think it is. There are some great female Viners.
Oh, yes. It could be just the list they selected.
Yeah.
Maybe guys are more likely to be yes. Ooh,
here you go. Elise Strachan. Host of the YouTube cooking channel My Cupcake Addiction, says a Facebook video may draw 1 million views and 900 to 1,000 comments. A live video may get only 100,000 views, but as many as 3,000 comments. So she says,
I don't know what to think about that.
Yeah, it's weird. More comments, but fewer views. When I'm live, she says, on my YouTube show, it's polished, it's perfect. When I'm live. So she is apparently one of these people getting paid. This is the Wall Street Journal. When I'm live, it's really me, like dealing with when your kid eats half the ingredients and you have to improvise. Ooh, that's probably fun to watch. According to the document viewed by the journal, Ms. Strachan may be paid up to $196,000 during 5 months to create live videos. She declined to comment.
So here's a question.
That makes sense, though.
Sure. Sure. Pay to play. They work hard. They deserve the money.
I was thinking about the viewership and the commentary, because the idea is the back and forth that you would be getting.
Right.
Which would be awesome.
Right. And those count as comments, right? Yeah.
That's what I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, Mike.
I just wonder if you can transfer a fan base from one platform to another. I mean, are there any known cases where you can simply buy people who emerged organically on Vine or YouTube and then transfer them to another service where they continue to grow and be it seems to me that certain types of people are ideally suited for certain platforms and thrive on that platform.
Yeah.
I mean, Vine is very different from YouTube, for example. And Facebook's trying to buy influence in this space. Is that possible? Has this ever been done?
I give you... I don't think so. I think that that's actually... This is Jeff Bezos' first Vine. I kid you not. This is Jeff Bezos' first Vine. He's an alien from Star Trek Beyond, I guess.
He's when it comes to signal to noise ratio, he really I think his first ever tweet was, "I just launched and landed a rocket."
Yeah. This is from the 20th, just a couple of days ago. No, wait a minute, that's today.
That's today.
A couple of days ago. That's right now. And I guess I've heard that he's an extra in Star Trek Beyond.
He's an alien, yeah.
Yeah, so this is
which is awesome. I would totally use my celebrity status as a CEO to get into, like...
Yeah, I hope that he laughs, because that would... His laugh is so distinctive.
He's the best.
That you would immediately know, my God, that alien's Jeff Bezos.
Is there a Jeff Bezos laugh ringtone?
There should be, along with the Stacey Higginbotham ringtone.
Ringtone.
That's the Stacey Higginbotham joy ringtone.
The ringtone of joy. Anyway, to answer your question, I think you're exactly right, Mike. I don't think it translates. And I think that we've already seen, we saw YouTube try to do this. They spent $100 million taking celebrities from other media to bring them to YouTube. And it didn't work. Shaquille O'Neal did not become a YouTube star. Yeah. As big a star as he is in the real world. So
there are YouTubers, though, and Viners that go to, like, the Disney Channel and other...
No, Fred Higgin... What was his name? Fred Figglesworth.
Fred
was a big YouTube star, and I don't think you could qualify his film career as successful. I think it is really very much... I don't know of an exception, but I think it's very much...
Oh, what about Erin... she's a sportscaster lady.
Was she a Vine star?
She had a vlog. She had a video, a YouTube thing.
Well, there are quite a few, actually, come to think of it, there are quite a few people have migrated from YouTube to mainstream success. That's not that unusual. But YouTube's more like real TV than Vine is. Vine is a very specific medium.
It is.
And it's a weird culture because, I mean, there are huge stars on Vine that you and I have never heard of because we're not Viners.
I love Vine.
Do you go every day? Will you go to Vine every day and look at?
No, I just like making them.
You make them.
I've only made a few, but yeah, I like shooting like tiny little 6 second videos. Like when we had this hedgehog in our house, I kept trying to make it do something interesting so I could Vine it because I just thought it'd be fun.
Was it a feral hedgehog or was it a pet hedgehog?
No, it was a pet hedgehog.
Oh, okay.
If it were feral, it would have been more interesting.
Yeah. I would say getting it out of the house was the main thing you should have concentrated on in that case, yes.
To me, the biggest question that I'm really curious about is what happens when YouTube's mobile live feature kicks in? Will that launch a bunch of live YouTube stars or not? Is YouTube ideally suited for the PewDiePie type of edited, polished videos? Or can it be a great medium for live? I'm really curious. I hope that it will spawn a whole new generation of YouTube live stars, but we don't know.
I'll bet it will. You know, but live is so the hot thing now, thanks to Facebook. The AP TV interviewed me today about Roger Ailes potentially leaving Fox News. And the guy who shot it said that now all the clients out there want nothing but live TV. It's all they want is live.
Yeah.
Media. Good.
Yeah.
I love that.
Live is awesome.
Live is great, right? That's what we're doing.
We're live.
Well, so we are and we aren't.
I know.
I mean, because the vast majority of our viewers and listeners consume it after the fact.
Which isn't that probably, you know, I haven't seen any numbers. Isn't that true of Facebook Live as well?
Oh, maybe, yeah. It's not true of TV,
certainly
obviously.
Well-known videos.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, on demand is a fraction of the total TV audience.
But that's because TV's.
But right. The fact, as well, you know, Leo, the fact that you do have some live audience, and it goes for Facebook Live and so on, completely changes what the content is and how it feels and all right. That kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Oh, wait, so here we go. Hi, Dad.
Is your dad watching?
He said he would be.
Nice.
Which I could only do if he were live.
Is your dad also in Austin, or is he?
No, he's in Houston.
Houston.
So, Stacey,
do people have pet hedgehogs?
You're still worried about the hedgehog. Yes, people do have pet hedgehogs.
I think they're legal in New York. Do people in Texas have pet armadillos?
I have never. Oh no, I saw my first live armadillo actually a year ago. So I don't think so. Maybe.
Aren't they beloved?
Oh yes, but they're like always dead in the middle of the road.
Did you like be a better giant to have them as pets and save them?
Oh yeah, you see a lot of armadillos on the roadkill. And
I think Jeff, we need to save the armadillos Texas. Campaign.
No,
Jeff's never been to Texas.
I was like, Texas doesn't think that way. If
incidentally,
we lost something, we kill it.
I just want you to understand how lucky you are, because not only can you openly carry a gun in Texas, you can have a hedgehog as a pet. Here in California, we can't do either.
I know.
Hedgehogs are illegal.
Mm-hmm. They're illegal in New York, I think. Doesn't New York classify
ferrets
them as...
Ferrets were outlawed for a while there back. I don't know about hedgehogs.
Ferrets, sugar gliders, hedgehogs, all illegal. In the People's Republic of California, my son drives him crazy. He says, "Why can't I have a hedgehog?"
Okay, they're not that great.
You have to get a license. They're not that great. They smell a little bit, don't they?
Just think of all the amazing things that will be legal after the Texit.
Texit. I'm voting for Texit. Here's a change.org petition you might want to sign: legalize hedgehogs as pets in the state of California.
Yep,
they didn't reach the critical number.
Leo, maybe you can change that.
Everybody now, I beg of you. What's that, Jeff?
So I downloaded the latest Nougat, and I can't get Google Now.
At all?
No.
That's a tragedy. No. I think Google's killing Google Now. Let's start a rumor.
Oh, no.
They're merging it with Plus and Hangout.
I'm changing it to Google Then.
Google Then.
It's going to be whoever was in charge of Google Wave is not going to be in charge of them.
SoftBank buys ARM for $32 billion, thereby co-opting, cornering, completely owning the entire Internet of Things market for now and ever. Amen. Right, Stacey?
Sort of.
Oh. What do you think?
I think this is really a crazy deal. I'm glad we're talking about it because
I see the note that says Stacey wants to talk about this.
Please. okay, so this is a surprising thing.
Yeah.
SoftBank, they actually have SoftBank, the carrier in Japan. They also own Sprint. And I gotta say that it was so crazy because no one thought ARM would go anywhere because they're so British. They're very British. You can tell looking at Simon. I mean, look at that guy. He's staid.
He also said, "This is a dark day for the British Empire."
That was another guy.
Okay.
It was the guy who founded it.
Yeah.
Not Simon. That would be terrible if your CEO said that.
oh, that's right. He's all for it.
He helped do the deal.
Yeah.
But he says in that video, actually, he says in the video that the only reason they did it is because they paid so darn much for it.
It's a lot of money. That's a chunk of change.
It's the second largest chip deal after Broadcom Avago.
Wow.
So that was $37 billion. So this is huge. SoftBank gets basically 95 almost every single mobile phone has an ARM-based processor inside. And ARM doesn't sell chips. They make the...
They sell the design.
They sell an instruction set, basically. Yeah. They sell the design for the chip. They own the mobile ecosystem. They are getting into microprocessors, which is the Internet of Things. But they do actually have competition there. And then they're also getting into servers. So they don't screw it up. There's like growth potential for them.
Oh, I think this is a deal. I know it's a lot of money. But I think... And SoftBank, by the way, I used to work for Sun Sun because he owns Ziff Davis briefly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think partly it's hard to understand SoftBank. It's more like Berkshire Hathaway than it's like.
Yeah, it's a private equity. This isn't a strategic deal for them.
It's an investment.
This is like, we have a lot of money. Let's put it someplace that's going to grow.
Yeah. And so they're not going to move Arm to Japan. They're going to let the same people run it. They want to own the proceeds. I think it's a great deal. They're going to own Internet of Things. They're going to own the future.
They will. Yes, they could own the future architecture for like just about everything.
Intel has taken a run at Arm and failed. In fact, Arm is basically putting Intel out of business in a way.
It is, and it's encroaching on their territory.
Servers.
Their high-margin server territory. Now, whether or not that'll actually happen, I don't know. They're also both going after the cellular equipment market with that used to have, like, ASICs, like, program, like, specially designed chips. The cellular equipment market is now, Arm's got stuff there, and so does Intel. So that could be interesting, too. And that's related to some of SoftBank's own interests.
Intel or Apple, somebody was rumored to be going after Arm. The problem is because it could really, and then in this article on Medium that you linked to, did you write it?
Oh, yeah, I wrote that one.
Well, there you go. That would be why you linked to it.
I was going to link to something else.
No, this is good. You point out that other chip companies really, because of anti-competitive issues, couldn't buy it. It had to be somebody like SoftBank.
Yeah, and a long time ago, I thought Google might buy it, but then Amazon and all of these other like data center companies that operate big data centers took Arm licenses. So then someone like Google couldn't really buy it.
I think this is a very exciting move.
I couldn't. If they put the money into Arm, I think it will be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and Apple, some question about Apple because Apple uses Arm, has licensed the Arm architecture to create the iPhone and iPad chips, but they have a perpetual license to this.
There's two types of licenses.
There's
an architecture.
Right.
Yeah, which means you can futz with the design as long as you
don't. That's what Apple has, right?
And that's what Apple has.
Yeah.
And Samsung and Qualcomm and all those guys. And then there's just like the straight up, we're just going to take this as it is and use it.
Like Raspberry Pi.
You can futz
Pi,
as long as you don't want, Stacey.
You can't futz with the, if you don't have an architectural license, you can't futz with it.
Oh, okay. I thought you were starting to say something about it. So you either buy
their design outright, which is cheaper, or you buy the right to use the design as a basis for your own designs, which is what Apple does.
Right.
It's kind of like Android.
Yeah. Except it's not. There's no free tier. ARM tier.
There's no free tier. And they make sure there are limits to how you couldn't like fork the ARM instruction set.
Oh, that's interesting. So Apple can't abandon ARM and just say, hey, we got it from here.
They could design their own chips.
But they'd have to start from scratch.
But they couldn't use the ARM architecture.
Right.
But ARM came about as Apple working with a company called Acorn Technology.
Right.
So for the Newton.
And Acorn did the BBC computer, I think. So this is really interesting. And by the way, it powers something that is in some ways spiritually the successor to the BBC computer, which is the Raspberry Pi. And that's also powered by ARM. And yes, the Apple put a lot of money into ARM for the Newton, one of the first mobile devices, and then sold its stake in ARM, but continued to use ARM designs. Didn't continue to. They restarted, I guess, with the iPhone and then later the iPad.
ARM is, it's such a quintessentially British company. Like, nobody knows about it. They don't talk about it. You know, you get Intel. Actually, Brian Krzanich isn't like this, but previous Intel CEOs were all like, you know, Intel inside, and they were so out there, kind of like Jensen is for NVIDIA. But ARMs, they've never been that way. They're just British.
Yeah. That's good. This is a dark day for the British Empire. We shall fight them in the trenches. We shall fight them in the trenches. When is Elon's master plan emerged yet? He's writing it now. He stayed up all night. He pulled an all-nighter. On crack, he tweeted. It was probably not true. What is his master plan going to be? It must have something to do with his acquisition of Solar City, right? I don't know. Anyways, he said he's finishing. This is this morning, 7:37. Finishing off the plan while listening to the soundtrack from Gatsby seems appropriate. He has a sense of humor.
He does.
Elon, I'm going to be at the factory at 11 on Friday. Come by, say hi. I'd love to get your autograph on my new Tesla.
Wouldn't that be cool to have a big Elon? Take a long one. Yeah,
take a giant Sharpie.
Elon Musk autographed Tesla. Now that would increase the value back up.
I promise never to sell it, Elon.
Never. I love you, man.
All right. I think we can. This blew me away. I saw this morning. Almost spit out my Cheerios. Seagate has announced 10 terabyte hard drives.
The helium drives?
The helium drives starting at $430. 10 terabytes.
We are living in amazing times.
That was exactly what I said after I picked up the Cheerios. Yes. 10 terabytes.
Yeah.
And yet people still buy 16 gigabyte smartphones.
Well, that's because they sell them for so much more if they're like 32 or 64. And some people don't even offer 64 at those punks. Okay. Yeah. I have feelings about this.
Well, this is not flash. This is a 7,200 RPM.
That's true.
Spinning drive. They call them helium because they're filled with helium. Not sure why. Some
also be used as a gyroscope.
Lighter
is
than
it
air.
Cooling?
Probably has something to do with that, right? Yeah. I can't imagine what the data density is in these drives. It's just unbelievable. I can remember thinking, oh, by 2020, we won't be using spinning spindle drives. It'll be all holographic memory. There's no way. but what no one predicted was the amazing increases in capacity that first IBM and then its successors were able to come up with.
Well, also, I don't think they were able to contemplate maybe the amount of digital detritus we'd like to keep.
Yeah, that there would be a market for it.
And I mean, because spinning drives are still so cheap, and then you look at like Facebook and their cold storage efforts, and I'm just kind of like stunned. By the way, someone did tweet me saying that the reason you don't have pet armadillos is because they carry leprosy. Which
okay,
never pet an armadillo, you guys.
Honest.
Nah.
Yeah.
Nah.
I mean, one of the things I think is interesting about the continued existence of physical spinning hard drives is that it kind of maps to the logic that Google was essentially founded on. When Google first started building up a sort of their search engine, when they were still at Stanford, when they first moved into the Wojcicki garage and so on, their whole mindset was, everybody else was like, how do we maximize reliability for each unit that's in this big store, you know, this big server? And Google's like, we don't care about that. We have software that will gracefully and quickly fail over across multiple semi-functional systems. The only thing that matters is how much does it cost? How much bang can we get for the buck, period? And so they were scraping together in the early days used hard drives that were problematic and used computers and servers and so on. And that's kind of been their mentality all along. It really, at the end of the day, when you have these huge, you know, they have an enterprise version that's been out for a while, but even for, you know, consumers who would need something like this, it doesn't matter if it's spinning hard drive. It doesn't matter. What matters is what's the cost per terabyte, I guess, in this case. What's the cost per terabyte?
Cost per unit of compute for them, or cost per unit of search for them. Yeah, and resiliency has become the key to not just Google and its hardware infrastructure, but even things like if you're going to build something in Amazon's cloud, the assumption is you build an architecture stuff, be it hardware or software, for it to go down and fail over somewhere else because it's so cheap. It's so great. Sorry, I get excited by this. Yep.
That wasn't your excited sound, though.
That wasn't as exciting. Okay. I have
her O sound was much better.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's new devices, cute dogs.
Well, let's take a break. Our picks of the week, including something very exciting on the Pixel, Jeff. Very exciting. I broke out my Pixel.
Ooh.
Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're in the enviable position I say enviable, not unenviable, of doing the hiring at your company. Why is that enviable? Because you building the company. You are the, Steve Jobs used to say, the company, the corporation is one of the highest creations of humankind. Because imagine getting a bunch of people together, pulling all in the same direction. You could do so much more than any individual can do. But any individual can make or break a company. A great hire, your company's to the moon. A bad hire, not so nice. That's why it's important that you do your job well. And we've got a great tool for you to do your job well, better, easier for you, better for your company, ZipRecruiter. See, the idea, I will float here. My premise is the perfect person for that job opening is out there. But how do you reach them? Which job board are they haunting? Are they using mobile phones and not desktop computers? How do you get to them? Well, ZipRecruiter maximizes your reach. With one post to ZipRecruiter, you're going to 100-plus job boards, plus social networks like Facebook and Twitter. As the most possible candidates are seeing it. You're also being matched instantly to more than 6 million resumes ZipRecruiter has on file because people go to ZipRecruiter to find jobs too. And then the nice thing is they click a link. They see that opening on some other job board. They click the link. They go to a ZipRecruiter optimized page that's going to look great even on their mobile device. You can apply through mobile at ZipRecruiter, which is neat. And then you don't get emails. You don't get phone calls. All of those candidates come into the ZipRecruiter interface where you can quickly screen them with real-world questions using free-form, multiple-choice, or yes-no formats. You'll be able to see candidate responses in conjunction with their resumes, easily to read, easy to rate them, screen them, and hire the right person fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. That's how we hired most recently hired our new editor. We use it. We love it. You will too. And you can try it free right now at ZipRecruiter.com/twig. ZipRecruiter.com/twig. The best way to hire the right person fast. Okay, time for tools, tips, numbers. Let's start. Why don't we start with Mike Elgin, who is visiting us from Aix-en-Provence as he continues his
Aix-en-Provence
digital nomadic lifestyle. I'm so jealous. I would love to be in the south of France right now. Man.
It is lovely here, and I am loving my pick of the week, which is Google Fi. Now, of course, Google Fi has been around for a while, and Stacey asked earlier in the show, should she get a Google Fi phone for your daughter, Stacey?
Yes, she's nine.
So the answer is yes, of course, you should. Google Fi has been awesome. Essentially what it is, it's an MVNO, which originally started out on two U.S. carriers, now is on three U.S. carriers. And the magic of Google Fi, because the phones, the Nexus phones that it's available on, have special antennas that enable them to quickly switch on the fly between both Wi-Fi and the three carriers. So if you're walking around and it will default to the fastest carrier. And if you wander into an area where another carrier is faster, it just switches you over to the other carrier. You never even notice it. You just always have reliability and speed. It's magic. It's wonderful. It's also great in terms of, and again, I'm talking about the existing benefits and I'll get to the new benefits in a sec. The pricing plan is so clear and so fair. So essentially, you pay a certain amount for the phone itself, so just for the account. So you pay, I believe it's $20 a month for unlimited domestic talk and text and unlimited international texts, and then you get a special rate on international calls if you're abroad and so on. And then you pay $10 per month for each gigabyte that you use. And if you have a budget, so you say, oh, I'm going to use 3 gigabytes, but then you only use 2, then they give you the money back. They give you the $10 back, and they do it on if you use part of that, they'll give you part of the money back. So it's like, it's for you, Stacey, one reason to give this to a 9-year-old is it teaches kids the value of a dollar, essentially, because they can monitor their usage. You're paying for what you get. And then if you're disciplined and you gravitate to Wi-Fi and change your behavior, you get money back. And it's a great way to see that in action, whereas other carriers normally obfuscate what you're paying for and so on. So it's great from that perspective. The other reason to use Google Fi for a nine-year-old is because it's like you're like the kid who owns the pool in the summer when it's 101 degrees in Austin, because your daughter can walk around and be the person who can offer a Wi-Fi hotspot to all her friends or anybody else who's around or can use other devices on that same Wi-Fi. So it's very empowering and freeing to be able to have a Wi-Fi hotspot anywhere you go. Now, what's new about Google Fi and why I really love it, and a lot of people didn't know this, but Google Fi internationally was throttled or capped to 256 megabits per second for the carrier. So if you're in an area with a super fast LTE, you were dropped down to 2G. Across the board, no matter where you went internationally. And this is one of the ways that they kept their costs in line, and everybody kind of accepted this. It's great to be able to go anywhere, and for the same price and doing nothing special, you get international coverage. You don't have to buy a SIM card, do all the gymnastics you used to have to do. But now all of a sudden, Google said, you know what? We're just going to lift the cap. No cap. Your data is as fast as the local data will give you. And it's like, wow. So in your areas where the carrier that they've got a contract with has LTE speeds, you get LTE speeds. I mean, it's a radical jump from 2G to LTE. I mean, it's wonderful.
And at the same $10 a gigabyte.
Yes.
Wherever you
are. Of course, you can burn through those gigabytes a lot faster now, but still, it's the same price.
Yeah, but you know, my son just came back from Barcelona. My daughter's in Mexico right now. And the anxiety, it's hard to understate the anxiety that you feel that you might have this $1,000 bill. You have to really be careful. And not with Google Fi. It's the same as in the States.
And it's wonderful. And, it's also an underappreciated feature is you can go to the website or use the app. And you can see exactly what's happening, how much you've used, how much you've spent. You can always just easily one tap and see what's going on with your account. You don't have to wait a month and a half to get the AT&T bill and realize, oh my gosh, you know, I gotta take out a loan to pay this bill because I've been abroad and I did the wrong thing.
Exactly.
I also have AT&T. It's a real problem. Google Fi is a godsend.
Yeah, basically, I just tell people turn off data roaming because you don't know what your phone's doing behind your back.
Even if you turn off data roaming, you can have a lot of problems. And one of these days, I'm going to write a column about some of the problems. For example, we suspended our accounts when we were abroad. We were abroad for like a couple of months, and then we went back to the U.S. And, you know, we were like, okay, we're back in the U.S., turn everything back on. And because we weren't on a Wi-Fi, all of these apps were updating. They had been waiting to update.
And we
kept hearing all night. It was during the night, not using the phone. We heard this bleep, and this was AT&T texting us saying, "You just incurred another $50." So frustrating. Anyway, so the other thing that's new about Google Fi is that they made a deal with the European carrier Three, which is in lots of countries, that it adds 15 countries to the total. So now Google Fi works in 135 countries.
With full bandwidth in how many of those? Not all of them,
All of them.
So are you using it in France right now?
Yeah, absolutely. Typically how I use it is I use an iPhone, right? So what I do is before we leave the Wi-Fi connected Airbnb that we have, I just turn on the phone, I turn on the tethering feature, throw it in my bag or my pocket, and off we go, and we just are connected. We can receive and make calls. We can get texts and emails. We can just function.
How many gigs do you tend to go through in a month then on Fi?
Oh, I keep it under probably 20 gigs.
A lot of that depends on where you are, if you have Wi-Fi readily available or not, you know, because where I work and where I'm at home. So I'm 20 bucks a month on Fi. It's very, very more than 20 because that's the base. But maybe 30. Right. It's very affordable compared to my other
stuff. But it seems to me like you would really get a lot out of it, Leo, because you buy so many phones. Do you really need to buy another data plan for every single
phone? Well, that's the issue. I wish I could use Fi. That's really okay. So there's two negatives. One, you can't get it outside the US. And two, that you have to have a Nexus phone, either a 6, 6P or 5X.
Well, but that's what I'm saying. If you just had a Nexus phone connected to Google Fi, and then you had all your other phones connected.
Oh, that's exactly what I do.
Wi-Fi hotspot. Yeah. So you're
exactly
you're
what
connected.
I do. Yeah. And I use Google Voice /Fi to forward calls to those other phones.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly what
and
I do.
And if you do, if you are going to get an Android phone and you do have Google Voice, one of the options when you sign up is like, yeah, just make that phone's phone number my Google Voice phone number.
Right.
And that's kind of cool.
It's a really good deal. I have to say, I've been very happy, and I'm going to be traveling in September to 10 different countries, and it's going to be such a boon to me. I was bringing a T-Mobile phone because T-Mobile, of course, does that limited data stuff.
And it also has to be said that you can just open up the app and say, okay, suspend it. So even if you traveled 1 month out of the year, you would only pay for that month that you're traveling.
Right. That's a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can have it just
for both. You can suspend the phone and data service.
You can suspend the data service. The phone, you got to pay for.
So you're going to get the $20 bucks a month no matter what.
I so wish for a MiFi.
Yeah.
When are they going to do that? When are they going to open to other phones?
Do you think carriers would be miffed at that, though?
Yeah, that's why. And I think you have to have some specialized radios in there to do
what you do. You must have to be able to switch around.
A tip for you, Mike, Signal Spy. Great app that will let you know what carrier you're on at any given time.
I'm on it.
Including Wi-Fi.
Have you had the problem yet, Mike, where it tries to connect to one carrier and can't and then doesn't connect to you at all?
Yes, I had that problem at first in Mexico, and I was going back and forth between you pick the carrier, and also I'd go back and, okay, I'm going to try each one serially. And I struggled for a while, but eventually it just worked for some reason. I don't know why, but so my son is texting me now. He's also a Google Fi user, and he says you can suspend both the phone and
it's the whole account. Google
Fi. Oh, awesome. Wow.
The whole account.
Yeah, that would be really useful. Then, so that makes
using it longer than I have,
for Jeff, somebody who travels all the time. That would be such a useful thing because you could have
not
your travel,
as much as Mike,
your travel phone. Yeah, no, it's worse though for you because at least Mike settles.
Yes,
you're in places for one day there, one day here, one day there.
Yeah,
but
I've been paying $100 a month to AT&T.
Yeah, like me too. And it's like I don't even use it, but I'm grandfathered in, so they got me by the. You know what? And so I can't leave AT&T, not with the unlimited grandfathered account. So
well, what I also pay for like $100 a month just for the foreign stuff, and I wanted to use Fi for a while to make sure I'm secure, and then I can pull my international AT&T not to zero because I still use that phone now and again, but way down.
Yeah, but this new lifting of the data speed cap is going to be huge.
Big deal
for you, I think.
But I think Stacy was asking a different question. I would guess, should a 9-year-old have a smartphone?
So it's actually, I don't want it to be as smart. We don't have a landline in our house.
So she and has since to have she a doesn't, phone.
But she has to have a phone. So I'm looking for a cheap phone. I mean, she has my old Galaxy 3, 4. I don't know which one it is.
Oh, so she does have a smartphone.
It's connected to Wi-Fi, but like making phone calls on that phone is.
Get her a 6P or a 5X.
Yeah, so that's because she uses the phone less for internet. She has got a computer with internet access.
It's the cheapest.
She uses it to record video.
It's the cheapest phone I've ever had. The other one that's actually it may be a little cheaper if you never leave the country is Ting, who was a sponsor for a long time. And Ting,
I know Elliot.
There you go. From Tucows.
Nice man.
Yeah, he's great. And so the thing about Ting is you just pay as you go, and it really we gave our father-in-law Lisa's old iPhone on Ting, and I pay it. It's like $9 a month. It's nothing. If you don't use a lot, you just pay for what you use. But I think Fi, Google has really reinvented smartphones. And presumably the new Nexus is, somebody told me it's not Nexi, it's Nexus.
I know, jeez, it's a joke, people.
Nexuses. Sonoses are Sonoses.
Well, it has to do with the noun, the Latin noun. If it's a, I can't remember the.
The CEO of Sonos, John, is it John McFarlane? Minded.
He says it's Sonai.
He says it's Sonoses. And I was like, Sonoses. How did you get to that? He's like, we just asked everybody. That was the consensus. Well, I was like.
The joke is, but Nexus is an actual Latin word. And it's, what is it, Karsten? There's some term for it. It's not intransitive, but it's a.
Karsten,
the old guy asked Harvard.
You went to Harvard.
You went to Harvard, tell us.
I went to a somewhat less good school, so I don't know.
Yale, man.
In any event, somebody sent me an email saying, well, as a matter of fact, Nexus is a.
I got the same one.
Gerundative or whatever, and the plural is Nexus.
Oh, like data.
Yeah, like, no, datum, data.
Well, that, oh,
that's
sorry.
Normal. That's a masculine noun, datum, data. But and there's data anyway. Never mind.
Who says the internet is stupid?
Well, who says Nexus is a Latin word is the other question. Of course, if we're saying Nexi, we're saying it's a Latin noun that is plural Nexi, but that's
we're
not
telling
correct.
A joke.
Hey, yeah, what's what else, next? We what can't else say do we have? Come do on. We've got numbers. Is something else happening?
Let's do Stacy. Let's do Stacy, and then we'll do the number.
Okay. Mine's really short.
Good.
Because
thank
I
you
was
for moving us along. By the way,
I'm getting hungry. I'm yes. like
she's getting
like,
hangry.
This is not a new book, but if you haven't read it, you can pick it up while you're traveling. It's called The Cartel, and it is awesome.
I saw the Netflix movie of the name. Is it the same thing?
I don't know. Was Narcos made? Or yeah. Are you talking about Narcos?
No, there's one also called, there's a movie called The Cartel, I think.
Well, my God, it might become a movie soon, you guys. You should read it before that. It's
about drug cartels, right?
It's drug cartels in Mexico. Yeah. It's well-written. It's great. We actually read a lot about actual drug cartels, and this hews very closely to how they work.
You live there. There's probably a tunnel under your house.
There is. Don't tell anyone. Crap. Now I've got to move, Leo.
You could build a wall, but there's always a tunnel.
So anyway, it's a really good read if you're into that. And my Kindle ran out of batteries, and I had to buy a book, and that was the book I bought, and it's good.
Yeah, there isn't a movie yet, so you're right.
Literary tip. I like that.
Yeah. You know what? Stacy, you want to recommend a book every week?
I will always recommend books. But
I love that. I would love that. Jeff, your number.
So I love this. The Wall Street Journal went and looked at, and they got evidently help from Facebook on this, getting data for correlations. Google usually likes to do this, but now Facebook is. Those who like Clinton or Trump, what they like in various categories of culture. So this Clinton awesome. Likers, and by state, but Clinton likers on music and bands primarily love Adele. Trump likers primarily like Ted Nugent and George Strait. actors and directors. Clinton likers, George Takei and Jada Pinkett Smith. Trump likers, Adam Sandler and John Wayne.
Oh, Lord.
And Kurt Cameron.
And Scott Baio.
Scott Baio now.
Chachi. We love Chachi.
This is a good one. Movie.
I want to hear from Potsy.
Most of the country by far.
Who's Potsy voting for?
Clinton lovers love Harry Potter. Yeah. Trump lovers like God's Not Dead.
I don't even know that book.
Oh, that's a movie in which a student who, what is the plot? The student says, is a Christian defending his beliefs.
Oh, you know what?
I was thinking God is Dead, the Christopher Hitchens.
No, not. Absolutely not. You know what? Guess like, what? My in-laws gave me the video of that. God's
Dead. No doubt.
And by the way,
television shows.
They're Trump voters.
Clinton likers like the Rachel Maddow show, of course.
Yeah.
Trump likers, Duck Dynasty.
Yeah.
Of course.
Who spoke at the convention? The chairman of the Duck Dynasty.
Clinton likers books. Here you go, Stacey. Books. Clinton likers like The Great Gatsby. Trump likers, honest to God, like The Old Farmer's Almanac.
The Old Farmer's Almanac. It's a great
book. I appreciate that was all of Texas right there.
And a lot of
Texas got it right.
And a lot of King James Bible. The Clinton likers are terrible because they like The Giving Tree, which is the worst book ever.
Oh, the Shel Silverstein book?
God, I hate that book.
That is really creepy because the thing, that's horrible. It is. Anyway,
like a Joel Osteen.
This is the most reductivist thing I've ever seen in my life.
And then, of course it is. And then athletes, let's see, Clinton likers, a lot of Serena Williams in the East, Cristiano Ronaldo in the West. And then for the Trump likers, I don't even know who is Ronda Rousey.
Oh, she's the UFC fighter.
Yeah, she's good. Okay. She got beat the other day, though.
Tim Tebow, Dale Earnhardt Jr.
This is
a little
dumb.
Bit of Tom Brady.
I got something better. I got something better. I got something better. Thanks to Nigel Town in our chat room. The Stacy Higginbotham ringtone.
Yay!
Oh,
turn on my audio. You got it?
Oh,
audience, you are the best.
Oh, oh, oh.
Put that on your daughter's Nexus 5X.
Oh, oh, oh.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, oh, oh.
Nigel Town, I think I love you, man.
You have to put it on your own phone.
Oh, oh, oh. I think I'll give that to my husband. He'll just be like, what just happened here?
We'll sneak it onto his phone tonight. Yes.
We like, Stacy's eating something again. She must be.
Oh,
That is so endearing.
All right. Well, it is endearing is a good word for it. I only have a minute
or
two.
Title too. Oh, oh, oh.
It is the show title.
Oh, oh, oh.
So. The minute we finished the show last week, Google pushed out the Play Store for the Chromebook Pixel. You have to put, so now it's two different Chromebooks or three. The first three that they mentioned, you have to put it in developer mode. So not developer mode. It's like you have to be in the developer track. It's different from the developer mode.
Yes.
But it's a setting in your settings, and then you will be offered here it is. This is the Android Store. Right there, front and center. And at this point, they're not restricting it. So you can download incompatible apps to your little heart's content. But one of the apps most of the apps obviously are not optimized. But Google makes Snapseed. It is optimized for the Chromebook. Finally, a powerful.
Wow.
Oh, unfortunately, Snapseed has stopped. Oh. Now, it is a little buggy. And in fact, what I found was that it's possible to put on here apps that slow your Pixel down to a crawl. So it's, you know, it's early beta. But
as I remember, Leo, it wouldn't work with my apps account.
But you see, I have, this is Telegram Messenger, and it is, you know, it's written in such a way that it scales. I also have Facebook Messenger. I have HipChat on here because we use that all the time. So these are Android apps that are running on Chrome OS natively. And it works, you know, for the most part, pretty well. Notice one of the changes down here in the toolbar, when it's when whatever's down here is a Chrome extension, it has a little Chrome icon on it. So you can kind of tell which is an app. Like here's the Chrome Store. That's an app. It's going to launch Chrome. And this is not. And it's so, in fact, in some ways, the Chrome extensions are second-class citizens on the new.
Yeah. Isn't that weird that the Chrome apps are the ones that have to be identified as being different?
Yeah. So you see, they're the ones with the little lower icons here. But I've tried a number of them. This is really exciting. It's an interesting thing. I don't know. By the way, Pokemon Go, because there's no GPS, doesn't run, on the Chromebook Pixel. Although if you had LTE, it would. So, you know, maybe you just need LTE. Anyway, this is exciting. We're getting close. Google says it will be on almost all new Chromebooks and many older Chromebooks sometime in the next couple of months. Android for Chrome OS is now out for the Pixel as well.
Wow.
Mike Elgin's in Aix-en-Provence in France. He is a digital nomad, and you can find out more becomingnomad.com. That's his blog. Of course, he posts on Google Plus, writes for Computer World, and is having a wonderful time. I follow him on Instagram and Facebook so that I can see all the delicious food he's eating. Thank you for joining
us. And delicious cheese.
And oh man, that cheese looked so good.
And delicious nougat.
Mimoletti.
And that website also has a newsletter if anybody wants to get my nomadic missives,
which I indeed do subscribe to, along with Stacy's newsletter.
I subscribe to both. Yes, that's Jeff Jarvis. He's a professor of journalism at CUNY, the City University of New York. He writes for Buzz Machine. You'll see him on Medium, and of course, many, many great books. One must buy them
when
all.
When the sun goes down, I turn pink.
I was going to say you're no longer a floating head in hands. I was loving that. I was just like a floating head.
As the sun goes down, I have to constantly try to adjust this thing to try to find humanity.
By the way, I'm moving from east to west here. So from France to New Jersey and now to Austin, Texas, Stacy Higginbotham.
Oh, oh, oh.
She's.
Oh, oh, oh.
The best sport ever.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, IoTpodcast.com. You must read her, subscribe to her newsletter, listen to her podcast, follow her on Twitter, and join her every week along with Jeff and other guests on This Week in Google. Thank you so much. Go get something to eat.
Oh, yes.
I hope you have something.
Yeah, it's really my dinner time. Yeah.
Yeah. Go eat. Go eat, kids. It's probably bedtime for Mike.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Well, it's France, so I'm eating really late. So
have a nice dinner.
Dinner time for me, too.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for joining
good to
us.
See y'all.
We do Twig every Wednesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern Time, 20:30 UTC. You can join us live if you want. Join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv or get it on demand after the fact at twit.tv/twig or wherever you get your finer podcasts. We thank you so much for being here. There it is. There's the website, twit.tv/twig. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next week on This Week in Google. Wait a minute.
Oh, oh, oh!